Welcome to Spotcast Season 3. This is our episode 21. This week we'll be talking about Discovery Season 3, Episode 11, Sukal. My name is Tim Mitchell and I am in Toronto, Ontario. I'm joined once again by Herm Lupus Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And also joined by Jonathan Kuline in Mississauga, Ontario.
Merry Christmas!
And Merry Christmas. Yes, Merry Christmas Eve, folks, as we record. The fat man is hitting the radar right about now. He's probably halfway around the world already.
Yeah, he's got his mask on. He's ready.
Yeah, apparently he's an essential worker in Canada.
Yeah.
And he's probably been to, you know, New Zealand and all those places already. So, spreading love and COVID all around. I mean, anyway. Alrighty, so let's just jump right in. I got some fact check. Oh, wait. Did I say the star date? No, I didn't.
No.
After all that fuss. This is star date 98581 Mark 89 in Toronto. Slightly different in Seattle. Anywho, fact check. We were talking about Salvador Dali's The Persistence of Memory, and I was saying I felt shame as a BFA student for not knowing that. In fact, he is a Spanish painter, so it was painted in Spain, and it was dated 1931, so that's when it would have been painted. And I've got a link here to the Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art, where in fact it is currently residing, even though nobody can see it. And last week we were talking about, was it The City on the Edge of Forever? Mm-hmm. Was the episode where McCoy gets, I said he had some sort of illness, some sort of fever or whatever, and I got it conflated with Naked Time. But what happened was there was something wrong with Sulu, and he had to give him some sort of cortisoid injection, some sort of, you know, fancy Star Trek term, but it was cortisone kind of thing. And McCoy makes a point of saying this is really delicate stuff. You got to handle it carefully. And something happens to the ship. They get bounced around, and McCoy ends up injecting himself in the stomach with, like, you know, the rest of the syringe, right? So, or hypospray. So that's how he goes bananas and starts yelling about murderers and runs off and goes and knocks out the transporter guy. Cause that's what you do when you're like, you lose your mind and you beam yourself down to a planet, you know? That's, you know, what first thing I think when I get, you know, hallucinogenic and stuff, right?
That's my first impulse.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's move on to the headlines.
So last week was the debut of the finale for season 2 of The Mandalorian, and we will probably have a good discussion about that in this episode, but, and then maybe it'll start here, there was a PS to the episode, which was amazing.
Wait, spoilers.
Spoilers!
Spoiler alert!
Spoiler alert, sorry. If you haven't seen the finale of that, skip forward a few minutes, we're going to talk about this. The episode was great, but there's also a PS scene. And in the PS scene, there is a major reveal. Now can I say it?
Now spoiler alert. Okay.
Spoiler alert. We're going to talk about Mandalorian season 2 finale and some of the details in there. So 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Skip forward a few minutes. We're going to get back to Star Trek in a few minutes.
I'll mark it in the chapter heading, so you don't have to count them.
There you go. So at the end of the episode, there is a PS scene right after the credits where Boba Fett and Fennec end up going to Jabba's palace on Tatooine, where we see a rather corpulent Bib Fortuna for the first time since Return of the Jedi, someone who we probably all assumed, maybe I'm wrong, maybe you didn't assume this, assumed was dead.
Yeah.
And Fett walks in.
Dayawanawanga.
That's the guy. Walks in and basically frees a slave and kills everybody, including Bib Fortuna, and then climbs up onto Jabba's former throne and plants himself there, looking very much at home, and a letters flash across the screen that spell out the Book of Boba Fett coming December 2021. And the episode
Can we talk about this?
So I'm just going to...
I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
So my question is this. Okay, so Boba Fett only has two lines in the entire series. The second line, he screams when he falls into the Sarlacc pit. Does he not get fall victim to the Sarlacc?
Well,
or does he fly away with his rocket thing?
Clearly not. So in the original expanded universe storylines, there's a novel, and in the novel it's called Tales of the Bounty Hunters. There is a story that outlines how he did not in fact die. He was ingested, but his armor protected him. He was in there, he figured out a way to get out, and he escaped. That has since been erased when Disney purchased Lucasfilms and they got rid of all that. They decanonized all that stuff, but they have since shown us Fett alive, and they have shown us Fett's armor damaged, and so therefore we can deduce that somewhere in there he escaped. Now, he was also pretty badly scarred, although we're not 100% sure that that was caused by the Sarlacc pit. That could have been anything.
So the fact that he's alive in the Mandalorian, see, the Mandalorian takes place after Return of the Jedi?
Yes.
They do talk about which Death Star when they mentioned the Death Star in the last episode, I think, right?
Mandalorian is set 5 years after the events of Return of the Jedi.
Oh, okay. Right.
So at the end of the episode, there was this, the Book of Boba Fett. And given the fact that the episode, which maybe we can do a quick recap now, but given that the fact the episode kind of wraps things up as far as the story of Din Djarin and Grogu a little bit, there was some speculation online over the next few days. There was some real confusion as to what this was going to mean. Does this mean there's going to be the Book of Boba Fett is going to be the next chapter of The Mandalorian? Is there going to be a separate series? So people were really confused for a few days there. And it was only beginning of this week they finally got clarification that the Book of Boba Fett is a completely separate series that is set to debut right around the same time as season 3 of The Mandalorian next December. So it's not going to be a separate thing. There was a lot of people speculating, well, because they've been calling these chapters, each episode is a chapter, maybe The Mandalorian is not Din Djarin, but The Mandalorian is all Mandalorians, and maybe it was going to be the first two seasons were focused on Din Djarin, the second couple seasons would focus on Boba Fett, maybe the fifth and sixth seasons would focus on...
Like The Crown, they'll have a different Mandalorian every couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe...
Except for the fact that Boba Fett's not really a Mandalorian.
Well, he is a Mandalorian. I don't care what...
Because if you wear the armor, you become a Mandalorian.
Well, the idea? But again, it's about the code, right? Like, he has his own code. And we saw that when one of the first things he does when he goes into Jabba's palace is free the slave, right? He has his own code.
Mm-hmm. I'm confused now. Now that Jaime's seen the, and we're still in the spoilerific
In the spoiler chapter on this episode.
Yeah, okay. Yes. So because I want to go back to when... the dude from that show with the guy who comes out with the Mandalorian armor.
Timothy Oliphant?
Timothy Oliphant. He has the armor and our hero, the Mandalorian, acquires that armor from him.
Yes.
Does he return it to Boba Fett at some point?
He does. In the episode where they put Grogu on the Seeing Stone, the one after Ahsoka appears, he's there, a ship lands, he goes down, and it turns out that that's when he meets Boba Fett, and Boba Fett's just wearing the black robes that we saw him in that cameo on Tatooine, and we see Fennec's alive but has been partly roboticized, and in that moment he basically says, I want my armor, it's mine, I want my armor back, and in that episode he gives him his armor
in exchange for helping them or whatever, right?
Yeah, and in the next episode it looks like it's gone through a restoration or a paint job repair or something like that, because it goes from pretty beat up when Timothy Oliphant's character is wearing it to looking pretty.
I feel sorry for the cosplayer people who have to go and now redo their armor.
Yes. So this is interesting because, you know, we just spoke in recent episodes about all of this deluge of Star Wars, Marvel, Disney, Pixar content that is coming to Disney Plus, and now we've got a little bonus, a bonus one too. It sounds like this is going to be more like an event series. It's not going to be ongoing quite as much. At least that's what the online news from StarWars.com seemed to indicate. So I don't know that it's going to go on ad infinitum. I think it's just meant to be a sort of a contained, you know, 8 episodes or whatever, and that's the whole run. But a nice little Easter egg, nice little carrot there at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, what are your thoughts on a Boba Fett spinoff series, and what are your thoughts overall on the finale? And I'm particularly curious about Jaime, considering you have sort of come into this fairly new and just sort of binged your way through it. What you thought of all this?
I thought it was pretty dang cool. First season of Mandalorian, I think, Baby Yoda aside, generally doesn't stray too far into fan service. Season 2, I think, leans more heavily into it, but not to the detriment. It does seem like stuff that was pretty reasonably written in and gave you areas for spinoffs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was pretty good. And I too was also sort of confused by the Book of Boba Fett of like, well, is this a different series that they just didn't want to announce because it would spoil things? Is it... Avatar style, where there's like different books in, like, you know, it's the same series but different sort of subchapters. And then I don't know if you want to go into the next link here that should probably still be in spoiler zone.
Yeah,
well, that Tim has there, on a certain character in the very, very interesting finale.
Yeah, there was a couple of things that I've heard too about this particular next point. Before we get there, though, I do want to say, I don't know why what it is, but I'm never been a fan of Jango Fett or Boba Fett. I mean, because Boba Fett like sold out Han Solo back in the day, but I don't know. I don't get they're villains and they repulse me, you know, like, I guess obviously that worked on me, I guess, as a young person or whatever. But maybe it's the actor, I'm not sure. I didn't really like the whole clone deal, that it was all this Jango Fett guy being, you know, cloned, or that Boba Fett was just another one of the clones. I mean, in Clone Wars, I do like the clones in the Clone Wars. I'm finding that's, you know, Rex and those kind of guys are and Fives, you know, those in 99, I guess, is a bad clone or something, like he's old or something, right? But I like the clones in the Clone Wars, but I'm never really a big fan of Jango Fett or Boba Fett. I don't know. I mean, mind you, Boba Fett's got that whole revenge thing against what's his name? Mace Windu, right?
Yeah, and they do a good bit of that in the Clone Wars.
Yeah.
They cover that off a little bit. I think the thing with... it's important to remember, too, that so Boba is an unaltered clone. He's a literal clone.
He doesn't age.
He doesn't age quickly. He doesn't do a lot of things. He didn't get the same kind of treatment that the other clones did. He's more of a pure version of his father, mm-hmm. or donor, as is sort of mercilessly pointed out in this finale. I don't know, Boba Fett was always a character I found interesting, but I think it had something to do with, you know, Star Wars in that era, it was the men in masks, right? It was, you know, Vader had a mask, Boba Fett had a mask, there was just something, you know, mysterious, what's under the mask.
Well, I mean, I did like that aspect of him in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. I did like the fact that he doesn't say anything, you know, and that he's got this sort of air of mystery. I think they've you know, illuminated too much in his story. Again, like I was saying before, I really like the mystique of the original Star Wars movie, A New Hope, that, you know, they dropped these sort of hints about things and they didn't expound on them. It's like seeing the alien in Alien. I mean, in the movie Alien, I liked it better when I didn't know what the alien looked like, you know?
Yeah.
Just a man in a rubber suit, right?
Yeah. I don't know. Boba Fett's always been a favorite of mine, and I think it was that the fact that he's so, like, he's standing beside Darth Vader. He's not standing behind him. He's not standing, like, he's like, I'm just as badass as this guy. And there was just something about that sort of swagger that he had, played so well by Jeremy Bullock, that sort of just the body language, the, you know, I could take you if I wanted to kind of attitude about him. You know, when Leia turns Chewie in Return of the Jedi, and he just sort of looks over and just sort of tilts his head, you know, like he owns the room. He's just got a real sort of badass vibe, which I think was very appealing.
Yeah, maybe that's what I mean. I think maybe the whole, they went too deep. They exposed too much of the character, I guess, is what I'm saying. What's the second one called? The second bad prequel thing called?
Oh, Attack of the Clones? Yes.
Attack of the Clones? Yeah, I mean, in that one there, you find, you know, I mean, I love the part where Obi-Wan goes and, you know, to investigate. I like that whole series, but I just the whole character, and, you know, I don't know.
How about you, Jaime? Are you a Boba Fett fan?
I like the character. I was never enamored with the character, as many in the fan base are. So I kind of sit in the middle, where I was like, oh, okay, yeah, let's see more of this character. But I don't know that I was clamoring for it, but I'm happy to see it.
Yeah.
I like the mystique of what's his name? Jin Djarin?
Jin Djarin.
Yeah. I mean, I like the mystique of him. I mean, you know, I like the way that Pedro plays him, you know? And you know, I like the sort of final reveal at the end of this series. I mean, like when the baby looks at him and says, "Can I see your face?" without saying, "Can I see your face?" Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that part. That was a kind of an interesting part. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me look on you with my own eyes. It's very, very Return of the Jedi kind of, you know, Darth Vader dying and, you know.
Yeah. What did you guys overall think of the episode? I thought it was a pretty satisfying conclusion, and the suspense build of the the X-Wing showing up and what's happening there was, I think, really well shot, really well made.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. I think, you know, as the hooded Jedi was walking towards, you know, the final scene there and dispatching all these guys. I mean, I kind of, you know, and you're supposed to think, oh, who could it possibly be? I was kind of hoping it was Obi-Wan Kenobi. And then I remembered, oh, wait a minute, he's dead, right? Or he's no longer corporeal, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess at this point in time, this is after Luke has dispatched the Emperor and whatever, right? So
mm-hmm. Yeah, at this point, theoretically, he's building his Jedi Academy, right?
Oh, okay, right. Yeah.
So he's rounding up Force-sensitive people from around the galaxy and starting to educate them and teach them the ways of the Force and regrow the Force.
Oh, I see. Right. Yeah. So he's out. Recruiting.
He's out headhunting.
He's a recruiting drive.
That's right.
Which brings us to like the link that got here, but two links here actually. One I picked up right after the show, and the second one is a tweet from Mark Hamill talking about spoilers. If you hadn't seen this part, but we're still in the spoiler zone. Mark Hamill said it's amazing that they were able to keep this quiet for a full year while they were working on it. And I'm just trying to read the pound STFU and the loose lips sink ships hashtags, right? Mm. So, you know, if you don't know what STFU is, then, you know,
yeah,
you haven't been watching, you haven't been following more than just code. it's Star Trek follow up, right? I think that was cool. I do have a complaint about the execution, but we can talk about that. So I'll let you guys expound on the reveal.
So I thought it was really well shot because of the way that they have the X-Wing pull in, and then there's the crack that is, you know, oh, great, one X-Wing, that's going to solve all of our problems.
Yeah.
And then you sort of get this systematic, like things are starting to turn, and then you see the hooded stranger ignite the lightsaber. But when you first see it, it's on the display on the bridge, so you don't know what color the lightsaber is.
Okay, right.
So I thought they did a really good job of just sort of stringing it out and just sort of building the suspense of, like, because again, your mind is racing. I was sitting here watching it with my son, and we were sort of looking at each other, okay, so, you know, the obvious answer is Luke, but there's still Ezra, there's still Kanan, there's still a possibility that at this point there are other Force-sensitive people.
Yeah.
So, you know, who could it be?
And I completely lost the timeline. So, I mean, if you think about it, I had no idea. It could have, from my perspective, it could have even been Rey, right?
Sure.
You know, except for the fact, the five-year thing, right?
And that's the thing. And I think it would have been nice to have maybe just a little sort of reminder in there somewhere for you know, sort of where we are and when we are and all that stuff too. But it was really good.
Tuesday, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, but it was really good, I think, the way that they built it up. And then when they cut to the scene where you see the green lightsaber, even then you think, well, Ezra has a green lightsaber. You're still not 100% sold that it's Luke. And then you see the glove and you're like, okay.
Yeah, as soon as you see the glove, yeah.
That's right. Gotta be Luke. That's gotta be the moment where I think your sort of brain tips to, like, oh, it's gotta be Luke. Mm-hmm. And then it sort of builds and builds and builds, and you're like, okay, yeah. Okay, now it's Luke. Which is, again, like, you guys know, I tend to sort of, you know, look for the angles on shows and stuff like that.
But when did you get the sense that it might, or you were just guessing all along?
He was the obvious answer, just given the timeline, and the fact that it seems like the Ezra, where is Ezra mystery is tied into the Ahsoka series. So it didn't seem like it was a good time for his reveal.
Right.
So my two thoughts were, one, it's Luke. Two, it's somebody we've never met before. And I thought the somebody we've never met before might have been a more reasonable option, just because I was thinking, how are they going to do Luke? There's been talk online that they were going to cast Sebastian Stan, who plays Bucky the Winter Soldier in the Marvel films.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Because he is a spot on exact physical match for Mark Hamill.
Okay.
It's eerie how much alike they look.
Right.
And so I thought, well, maybe that. But I really did think it made more sense for it to be like, you know, oh, we've never met. My name is blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether it was more or less satisfying. I listened to a couple of pods and and I read some articles just to sort of see what other people are thinking, and then I saw some good points. One of the points that I heard that I really thought was a good one was, I kind of want the Mandalorian to stay the hell away from the Skywalkers.
Yeah.
And it's not, that's not my idea. That's just, but when I heard that, I was thinking, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. The idea that
it's a big galaxy, right?
Well,
it's a big universe.
And there's, so now you think to yourself, okay, do they, so they've theoretically, Grogu goes off with Luke to go and be trained and sort of move on with his life, which opens up the possibility that he was slaughtered with the rest of the trainees when Kylo Ren and his Knights of Ren do their thing, which is a horrifying prospect. But it, you know, when Din says to him, you know, we'll see each other again, I promise, it makes me think, you know, where, like, what's going to happen? How's this going to shake out? How are they going to reunite them? Like, Baby Yoda is the cash cow star of this series. It seems strange that they've written him out, but then it also makes a lot of sense too, because, you know, the story kind of played itself out too. It is limiting where, you know, in every episode they're like, oh, there's the guy in the bulletproof armor with the baby in a bag. There's only so much you can do with that, you know?
It seemed to be a limiting thing. It's like when they say in combat, don't grow a ponytail because it's a way somebody can grab you, right? Well, the fact that his hand is always holding onto this little, you know, precious cargo makes him limited. I was going to come back to just to, you know, from the point of view, if you didn't know the whole 5-year thing, right? I mean, it could have even been Anakin Skywalker at some point, because the strength with which that Jedi was dispatching the black squadron, or what do they call them?
Dark Troopers.
Yeah. Which is from a 90s video game.
Right? It is in fact true. Yes.
I mean, that, it could have, it, you know, it had to be somebody at that sort of level of control. Right. And so can we talk about the lack of deep fake in this particular execution?
Yes.
I mean, yeah. So I've always been critical of CG rendering of human faces, right? Like, what was that, Final Fantasy or something like that? They did back in the
Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was a great, wonderful thing, except nobody's foreheads moved.
Yeah.
Their eyebrows didn't go up and down. They didn't crinkle. They didn't, you know, like, it was like, they were like masks, you know, and yeah, their mouths moved up and down, but it was like, okay, then don't do that. Like, do what they did with Clone Wars, you know, like, do something 3D that's not 3D, you know? And we've talked about it on this show that, you know, we've seen the deep fake stuff that they did with Chris Pine and William Shatner, and we've seen it, Carrie Fisher and whatever that was in Rogue One. And I, you know, like right from the get go, Christopher Plummer.
He's in everything. That guy's everywhere.
Grand Moff Tarkin is played by
Peter Cushing.
Thank you very much. That's close to Christopher Plummer. But so Peter Cushing, like his whole piece. I mean, like, I went back and watched A New Hope just to see, like, what was it about that 3D rendering that bothered me? And it was just sad. I mean, like his face just didn't move like a human would move. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, Peter Cushing was amazingly menacing in that first movie, you know, it's too bad that they got rid of him, like, you know, by blowing up the Death Star. But then again, that was the whole cockiness of that character. That's it, right?
Yeah, he's supposed to die hoisted on his own petard or whatever.
Yeah. So we have this technology and, you know, it's, I don't know, maybe the, again, this is probably was in the can like a year ago or 6 months ago or whatever. Maybe it was just a time thing, but it was Mark Hamill's voice. I don't know who the actor was who played the character, like who was the stand-in for him. If it was, I don't think it was Mark Hamill, but they could have done much better, in my opinion, especially like now, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I've seen the deepfake stuff that does the side-by-side, and I do think that deepfake technology is something that should be brought out of the toolbox more often than it is. It suffers, not the deepfake, the one that they had in Mandalorian. I mean, it's pretty good, but I think it suffers from the same sort of slightly off thing that you saw in Rogue One. And yet the deepfake stuff, granted this is on YouTube, so, you know, caveat there, it looked pretty good. I feel like it was more convincing. Not 100%, like it wasn't going to confuse me, but I still feel like it was good enough to pass.
Yeah, I mean, I had the same feeling about it that I did with that Peter Cushing scene in Rogue One, where I thought, it's not quite there. Like, I honestly feel like I would have been happier if they had cast Sebastian Stan.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if he was not quite perfect, but close. Like, well, I do respect to Mark.
As soon as you saw the glove, you knew it was Luke Skywalker.
Well, and do respect to Mark. Like, if it had been another actor who looked very similar to what Mark looked like in 19... Well, it's not 83. It would have been 88, I guess.
Yeah.
I would have been fine with that and would have not questioned, oh, that clearly isn't, you know, Mark, like Mark Hamill. Like, of course not. Mark's in his 60s. Like, that wouldn't make sense. I don't think those moments are as satisfying as I think the artists intend them to be. Now, maybe they'll go full Lucas on this stuff in time, and maybe the technology will improve to the point where they can go in and they can sort of polish it up. And it's funny because I loathe some of the choices that Lucas and his team have made to the original films over the years, but I think I would be okay if they did go through with Rogue One and this, and the Carrie thing at the end of Rogue One as well, and did put the best effort forward on it. You know, like, I don't think it would alter the substance. I don't think I want the words to be altered. I don't think I'd want the substance of it to be altered. But if they were going to make it look closer to a human being emoting and speaking, I'd be fine with it, I think.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It was very cardboardish. Like, you know, I kind of expected that in the early 2000s, not 2020. Right.
No. It was disappointing in that way. But that being said, the whole scene was incredibly badass.
Well, yeah, even R2-D2 popping around the corner there too, right?
Like, and there's a moment too, like, I don't know if you guys caught that, but there's a moment too where there seems to be some recognition between Grogu and R2. They seem to know each other, which...
Really?
Well, yeah, because R2 does his little bleep and Grogu sort of like reaches for him. Like, they would have clearly crossed paths at the Jedi Temple if R2 was Anakin's droid through that whole stretch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They'd have crossed paths. So, the one big mystery...
But Grogu was never in the temple.
Yeah, he was. When Ahsoka is communing with him in one of the three episodes previous, she says he was trained by many masters at the Jedi Temple. Someone spirited him away before Order 66. That's the big mystery that still has not been reconciled, is who got him out.
Right. And what's Order 66?
The Emperor's subliminal message to all the troopers to kill all the Jedi.
Oh, okay, right.
So there's some really cool little moments in there. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, I and many other people, maybe me to a lesser extent, Phantom Menace has some good moments. It has some good moments. It's not a great movie, but it has some good moments. One of the things I was most looking forward to when it was announced and even when it was brought to life was I always wanted to see a real Jedi kick ass. We got an old man and a trainee in the first trilogy. That's what we got.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Admittedly,
it wasn't even a trainee either. Yeah.
Well, and admittedly, Luke got better over the course of time. The fight on Bespin, he's a little amateurish. And the fight on, or in Cloud City rather, and the fight in on the second Death Star, he's better, but he's still not what I was hoping for. We kind of got the same deal in Phantom Menace. We got an old man in Qui-Gon Jinn, and we got a kid in Obi-Wan. So we didn't get quite there, but it was still pretty badass. That first scene
with that amazing Darth Maul versus Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan,
that seems really good. But again, like, you'd think in his prime Jedi Master versus Darth Maul is a much more fair fight than the older man and the mm-hmm. kid. Mm-hmm. I think seeing Luke theoretically at the peak of his powers, he's a Jedi now, he has vanquished mm-hmm. the Emperor, he has taken his place, he's regained his mantle, and he is as badass as he's ever going to be. You know, we never really got to see that period of him. We got to see him at the end of Jedi where he's sort of like, I'm there. And then we get him as the, you know, the vagrant drinking blue milk straight from the teat. And, you know, we don't really get that Luke in the peak of his powers. And just to get even a few minutes of him just being like, dark troopers, give me a break. And just mowing these guys down because he is as badass as he can get. That was amazing.
That's what I said, like, from the point of view of the skill level as a Jedi,
just
flicking these guys away, right?
Yeah,
and squishing mosquitoes, you know, sort of thing.
Well, right? This is Gretzky in his prime, right? Like, this is, you know, this is whoever it is and whatever they do at the pinnacle of their career. This is somebody who is in, you know, complete control of the Force using his telekinetics, using using his, like, he crushes the guy's helmet using his lightsaber, you know, just really, really cool to get a little taste of that.
Yeah, I think, and I think that, like, if I'm not mistaken, I think, not Christopher Plummer, the other guy, Christopher Lee, in Return of the Jedi, they throw things, so the Emperor throws stuff at Luke, right?
Well, but Vader does it when they're fighting in Cloud City, right? That's the first time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the first time we really see that level of telekinetics I can do so much with my powers. Because he does that whole thing where he starts flinging things at him and then just throws them right out the window with the Force, right?
Yeah, and Yoda with a lightsaber in
Attack of the Clones.
Against Christopher Lee, that was a bit, you know, yeah. I still find that comical. It's like Tom and Jerry almost, right?
Yeah.
Because even somebody as sophisticated as Yoda, I would think wouldn't even need a lightsaber, right? That's kind of how badass he would be in my mind, right?
Well, and it's a funny thing too, because we've established now, like, we knew when Yoda died, he was, you know, 900 years old.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Grogu is 50 and still acts like a very small child. I wonder at what point their species is at their peak, because I don't think even during the Clone Wars, Yoda was probably the equivalent of an older man. You know, he still is walking with a cane. Yeah, he could bust it out when he needs to, but, you know, it's like if I put you in net right now, Tim, and fired some pucks at you, you'd be there, but you'd probably feel it the next day, you know? I think Yoda was probably, you know, the next day he was walking that cane a little harder, right?
Yeah, he's like Mr. Miyagi coming in to beat up the Cobra Kai guys to save Danny LaRusso and Karate Kid, right? He's still able to kick butt, but definitely not a in the prime man.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it is nice when we get these glimpses. And I will say that's the one thing I kind of liked about some of the animated stuff we've gotten between Clone Wars and Rebels is, you know, we got to see some of the different Jedi just being badasses, being these incredibly powerful creatures and people who could, you know, use this power to great ability. And that was kind of neat. We haven't really got a ton of that in live action.
Right.
You know, even, you know, look at the new trilogy. It's the same old story, right? Oh, a newbie. Oh, she's super powerful, but she's really raw and she can do some things, but she can't do others. And
she has all these, you know, I guess she's got some, you know, she needs to develop some skills or whatever. By the way, you know, we should start a podcast on Star Trek.
You know, I think that could be a hit.
Well, on that note, let's go back to, like, let's get out of the spoiler zone, so, because there are people who have skipped like 35 minutes of us talking about Mandalorian. Anyway, so let's move on to the rest of the show here.
All right. Next up on the headlines, this was something that I think we talked about, and I think that has been expected, and it's finally coming to pass. So MGM, the studio that owns the rights to properties like the James Bond franchise, the Hunger Games, Hobbit, Handmaid's Tale, Rocky, pretty good household name stuff. 4,000 movie titles, 17,000 hours of television programming. They have decided that they are exploring the possibility of selling their assets, selling their library of content. Now, given that we've seen the kind of acquisition of the Fox assets by Disney and the difference that that kind of thing can make to support and just be this influx of content for to essentially catapult yourself to number one, it'll be interesting to see as this story starts to develop what this will mean if, for the sake of argument, Amazon or
Apple
decide, hey, this is worth a few bills, let's get it out there and see if we can draw in a few more users, if that'll help do for them what acquiring Fox did for Disney.
Yeah, I think if you're Apple, this makes the most sense for you, device, right? So just turn right to the camera and be like, look, your market cap is in the trillions, you have billions of dollars of revenue, you could very easily spend whatever it is they're asking here, let's call it $10 billion, right? Let's call it $10 billion as a nice round number that they're offering their sale for. You just write the check and be like, cool, we're done. Check's in the mail. You'll get it. Because this immediately solves the, hey, Apple TV Plus is nice. They've got some good stuff. Maybe not as many must-haves. There's no Game of Thrones equivalent that, like, everybody needs to go see this. There's no Wonder Woman 1984 of, like, wow, everybody's going to subscribe to watch this. you immediately solve the back catalog problem that gets you through this next COVID year, right? And people say, oh, for $5 a month, yeah, that actually sounds pretty good. I can watch all these movies after I've finished what's currently available as the originals. It becomes the why was Disney Plus so successful right out of the gate, given that the only new content it really had was The Mandalorian for a very, very long time? Because it had all the Disney stuff, right? It was like, here's all the Marvel, here's all the Star Wars, here's
Simpsons,
you know, it's Simpsons, here's all of the, like me, like I've been watching a whole bunch of Disney cartoons from like the 1930s, right? Because it's there, it's all there.
Yeah,
the same thing true with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer is the catalog of 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s movies as well, right? Like,
oh, and right into modern times.
I can't tell you the number of MGM movies I've seen in my lifetime, notwithstanding the stuff that's been out in the last 20 or 30 years, right? So
yeah, I mean, some of the other stuff they talk about, obviously more modern stuff, Creed, the whole Rocky franchise, including the new Creed, which has been a very successful franchise, Terminator, Silence of the Lambs, Rain Man, you know, Hobbit, there's some pretty big stuff in here. And it is, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, if you bought it at the right time, you'd own the rights to No Time to Die, the new James Bond movie too. So you could say, hey, we're making this splash. And by the way, you want to see the new James Bond movie? Only one place.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I mean, and the reason I mentioned Apple was, like, I was thinking from the deep pockets point of view, right? Like, in terms of who could afford to sort of,
I think Bezos has got a couple, this, right? Couple of shekels to rub together if he wanted to acquire this too.
Bezos, yeah, mm-hmm. Bezos is one. Mind you, his wife is giving away half of his money, but his ex-wife, I guess.
Well, there's a lesson in that one too.
Yeah, but I mean, there's some big players. Tesla is another one, apparently. But it's an easy decision if the price is right or whatever, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. For those people, right? Hmm.
Yeah, it says in this article from Variety that the market cap, including debt, is $5.5 billion for MGM. So even if you overpay, you're still, we're not talking about Fox. This is not Fox. This is a smaller studio by comparison.
Right.
And well within the wheelhouse of Amazon or Netflix or Apple to acquire. The real coup would be if Disney decided to throw down on this as well.
Because then it would stomp out the competition.
Well, that's it. I mean, at that point, the tipping point might have already been reached between their own original content, their previous acquisitions of Pixar, Marvel, and Star Wars, plus acquiring the Fox assets, which they're going to monetize by turning things like Aliens and Predator and all these other things into shows and movies and everything else, plus Avatar, plus they add the James Bond stuff on top. Like, it would just be murder. My only thought on that one is, I wonder if there'd be an antitrust lawsuit.
Or like a monopoly thing that they do in the States.
Yeah, right? that's antitrust. Yeah, like I honestly feel like that would be the sort of next thing, because they're basically gobbling up competition at a certain point and creating a monopoly.
Was Steve Jobs around when Pixar was picked up by them? I wonder.
Was Jobs?
Steve Jobs, yeah. Like when 2013, I think.
I think he might have still been his secondary CEO job.
Yeah, because he was one of the three people that put that together, right? So, that was in his on Apple days, right? When he started that stuff.
It'll be interesting to see what comes of that one. We'll definitely have our eyes peeled on it.
Yeah, cool. What do you got first, Jaime?
Whole bunch of DC Comics related stuff coming to HBO Max. So very similar to the way we just talked about Disney acquiring all of its own IP again and reacquiring it and putting on its streaming service. HBO with Warner Brothers said, hey, that's actually a really good idea. Let's continue. So Batman, the animated series, and Batman Beyond, both really, really excellent animated series from the 90s, are coming to HBO Max in January, including a whole bunch of other stuff. Maybe some stuff we've mentioned before, like Green Lantern, the animated series, Justice League Dark, Apocalypse War, Batman Bad Blood, Superman Doomsday, Superman of Tomorrow, a whole bunch of stuff that is coming. But certainly the marquee ones are the Batman, the animated series, and Batman Beyond, that are really, really, really top notch. And the whole reason that you know Mark Hamill's voice as the Joker, and you know Tim Conroy's voice as Batman, Bruce Wayne.
Kevin Conroy.
Sorry. For some reason I slur his name and Tim Bruce or Bruce Tim together. Bruce Tim,
yeah.
In my head to create one new person. But yes, Kevin Conroy. It's pretty. Pretty good for me, because I'm going to be subscribing to HBO Max sometime this weekend to watch Wonder Woman 1984. It may not be tomorrow. It's certainly by 9 a.m.
Well, that's coming out tomorrow, right?
9 a.m. Pacific, 12 in the afternoon for you East Coast folks. I don't know how literal and down to the minute HBO Max is for its 30-day subscription, so you might want to wait, you know, like 2 hours into that period before you subscribe, just in case.
Where are we watching that one in Canada?
They've been putting commercials on network television. I watched the first Raptors game last night, and I saw their commercials up. It just says in theaters and available on streaming platforms.
Surfaces. Okay,
it doesn't specifically say. I would imagine by tomorrow midday we'll see ads on iTunes, and it may be on like a Rogers On Demand or something like that as well, or you know, whatever your cable provider, you know, those pay-per-view kind of things. I think the most logical place for Canadians to look would be someplace like iTunes.
Yeah. I mean, that's for all that we complain about this, you know, digital borders, that's something that you know, they could handily do, right? You know,
yeah.
I mean, screw you, US, you get to watch it on something different.
Well, and it is still kind of, I mean, it's not quite equitable in the fact that, you know, Jaime, what are you paying for a month of HBO Max?
I believe, let me double check. I thought it was $14.99, but it might be $19.99. Let me double check that. I haven't paid for it yet, so I don't know.
And that's US too, right?
Yeah, one sec.
So if it's, for the sake of argument, if it's in that ballpark, that's for a month of a service that includes all those things that we've talked about, plus Wonder Woman, you know, all the other bells and whistles that you can watch, whereas we get one movie for 48 hours or $30 Canadian. That's what you get.
Oh, we don't get to buy it. We just get to rent it.
It is not available for purchase, as I understand it. It is only available to watch for a limited amount of time or a couple of days.
Right. So let's see here. So real-time follow-up here, $14.99 a month. There is a six-month prepay, $69.99. And they actually have a Wonder Woman 1984 countdown. There is 12 hours and 42 minutes and 34 seconds to go. And stream it on HBO Max at 12 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Christmas Day. Available on HBO Max for 31 days from its theatrical release.
Oh, so you get to watch it over and over again? Like, you don't have to watch it within 40? We're just talking about that while you were away. Like
No. I was trying to get this straight in my head, because this is the frustrating thing of the streaming era, is that it is not consistently the same. So I'm speaking of it from an American standpoint, because I know that for sure. You can watch it multiple times, but if you subscribe, you know, on the 32nd day, you get no time to watch Wonder Woman 1984. So this is free, if you know, effectively free, because if you're subscribing for all sorts of other stuff for HBO Max, but it's only there for a limited amount of time.
And then so you get it for free if you're a subscriber? You don't have to pay like an extra...
No, yes, this is like, it's like your socialized sci-fi that I like to tease you all about, that like, it's free with big air quotes of like, you know, assuming you're paying for something you would ordinarily pay for.
Right. And you get 3% off if you use your Apple card.
Oh, I don't know how to pay. Sign up now. Do I get to pay with Apple? I don't see an Apple Pay option, so no, I won't get extra percentages there.
I'm just pointing at the fact that we don't have Apple Pay in Canada as well, you know, just for the record.
The Apple card, you mean?
The Apple card, yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry, we have Apple Pay here, correct. Apple card, I meant. Did I not say Apple card?
I am not sure. We'll have to check the tape. I heard Apple card in my head.
Word card. I'll just, for those of you driving at home, or transporting at home, I'll put the word card in. So it doesn't sound like I said Apple Pay when I meant Apple Card. All right. Or maybe I won't. Maybe you'll just have to believe me, or rewind and see if I fixed it or not.
Hey, speaking of HBO Max, our last news item is that we've got a renewal for His Dark Materials coming back for a third and final season on HBO. It is interesting that they're doing that, because it was a 3-book series. It's interesting that they're going to do the whole run in 3 years. But
and what did it start with? It was not that the first book is not Dark Materials.
No, it's Golden Compass. The Golden Compass is the first book.
Right.
And I don't know if the first season follows just the Golden Compass storyline, or if it goes further or beyond.
Are we supposed to go back and like watch the Golden Compass first and then come back and watch this?
I don't think so. I think the first book, the first season covers, like, it's, I think it's a completely different thing than the Golden Compass film. But it is kind of nice that it is wrapping up. And it actually, I don't know about you guys, but when I looked at that news, I sort of looked at it and thought, great, I'm not going to bother watching the first two seasons. I'll wait till they're done season 3 and then I'll watch the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
So I just looked this up because I was confused by what you guys were saying. I've not read the novels, just to be really clear, but according to Wikipedia, His Dark Materials is a trilogy of fantasy novels by Philip Pullman, mm-hmm. consisting of Northern Lights, which confused me, but then it says published as The Golden Compass in North America. So being this is an all North American show, I can see why we all thought the same thing there. Then followed by The Subtle Knife and The Amber Spyglass. So it seems correct to have like three. I've not seen any of these, but if there are three seasons and you have one book per season, sounds about right.
So what is it about North Americans that were afraid of sorcerers and dark materials?
Wait, did you guys get Sorcerer's Stone or Philosopher's Stone for Harry Potter?
I, you know, to be honest with you, I can't remember.
I think it was Sorcerer's Stone across North America.
Yeah, I don't think we didn't get... No, wait, so which is the original British title?
Philosopher.
Oh, okay. That doesn't make sense. Sorcerer's Stone is a much better title.
It's a cooler title, but the hoity-toity, as I say with tongue-in-cheek, British folks will say, wait a minute, but the Philosopher's Stone is like a real thing in mythology that's talked about. Right? It wasn't just made up by J.K. Rowling.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
Real in the fantastical sense and like, you know, like Jason and the Argonauts and the Golden Fleece sort of real.
Yeah. I have no discussion about that.
Yeah, I can, as an American, just for folks who are brand new to the show, welcome to y'all. As an American and very proud of it, I can understand why they would just assume Americans are too dumb to know the reference for the Philosopher's Stone. I don't know why Canadians got dragged into it as well. So I'll leave that as an exercise for the reader.
Yeah, maybe it's just more, a more common understanding of that terminology in Europe. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, to me, like, to me, a philosopher is like Socrates and Kant and David Hume. It's not so much, you know, some sort of mythical Merlin-esque kind of guy, right? Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. Are we there yet?
We're there!
Have we arrived? This is the part of the show where we talk about Star Trek Season 3, Episode 11, Sukal, as opposed to Saru. But and I don't know who's taking the reins this week.
That would be Jonathan? Me, yeah.
Ooh, there's no massive pasting into the document to, you know, toy with the gods of Google. Anywho, off you go.
All right, so we start our episode with exactly where we left off. It is the crew gathered in their lounge, and they are still raising their champagne glasses in the memory of Philippa Georgiou, the emperor who has left the ship and left the series. And we get in a little scene where Adira is sort of standing off to the side, and they are sort of taking it all in and sort of, you know, feeling some mixed emotions. They're playing it across their face, and Stamets comes over and talks to them and sort of says, you know, this is not exclusionary. You're part of this. Like, don't feel like you need to sort of stay separated from it. You know, you're part of this family, and you're also part of this family. And he gestures over to Hugh, his partner. And, you know, I think in that same way that we've seen that relationship growing, where the two of them are sort of feeling a sense of parental responsibility for Adira as they mature on the ship and sort of come into their own. And while this is happening, then we get the return of Gray, who has been missing for a few episodes. And Adira sort of says, you know, oh, Gray is here. And Stamets, without being able to see Gray, sort of says, you know, hey, if I wasn't here, you know, if I could actually see you, I'd give you such a piece of my mind, which is a pretty funny little scene. And we get a little reunion where, you know, Gray and Adira are speaking, and Gray sort of says, you know, I just, you know, I'm having a really tough time with this. You know, you get to interact with the whole world around you, and all I get to do is talk to you, and I'm having a really tough time with it. And Adira says, well, you know, I hear what you're saying, but, you know, doesn't make it okay that you disappeared.
How is that my problem?
Yeah, yeah. So, interesting little sort of exchange between the two of them, mm-hmm. which spoilers as we go through this episode, they never really circle back to in this particular episode, which was a little... I assume it's going somewhere over the next couple of episodes, but it never really resolves. This sort of return of Gray is very short-lived, because while they're having this celebration, we cut from Adira and Gray's conversation.
Well, before we move on.
Oh, yeah, you want to get into it now? Okay, go.
Yeah, well, I just want to ask, why does Gray cast a shadow on Adira's frontage there?
I think the notion, well, one, they made a mistake, but I think you could interpret it as they are seeing being, in their mind, gray, and gray is real, mm-hmm. so therefore gray would have all the physical properties in Adira's mind.
Okay.
Right, because notably, you don't see gray's shadow when Stamets is talking, right? And we see the scene from Stamets' perspective. Right, there is no gray there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true, yeah. And like I said, like we're not seeing things through their eyes. Mm-hmm. We're seeing things like as somebody looking at the two characters discussing, mm-hmm. right? Anyway, mm-hmm. just, you know, continuity.
Yeah, honestly, I think it's just
a little bit of Photoshop.
I think it's just a continuity error that in the grand scheme of things, you could find a rational explanation or you could just, it happens. So we get the update during the middle of this celebration that the program that they have been writing to try and get information on the source of the signal inside of the Nebula has returned the information that there is a life sign aboard the Kieth, the Kelpian ship that is trapped inside. And we get a little bit of information from Saru, who says, they say, how is that possible? The ship's been in there for over 100 years. How could that be that this has happened? No way anybody could have survived. And Saru explains, well, actually, when you guys were looking at the hollow of the doctor, the scientist who's leading the mission in the previous episode, you thought she was showing signs of radiation damage already. In fact, that is what Kelpians look like when they're pregnant. And
oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. So we get this sort of data download that if there's a life sign there, it could be this offspring. So into the nebula they go. So they are, decide they're going to go in. They go into the nebula and instantly they're regretting it. It turns into a real mess fast. The shields are failing, the ship's being buckled, it's taking a pounding. Like, they clearly cannot do this. Book, who is still looking for his ways to prove himself, says, hey, let me take my ship. My ship's smaller, it's more maneuverable, I can do this, I'll take care of it. You go take your spore drive and get the heck out of here and wait for me and I'll suss it out for you. At this point, I just want to raise that for some reason, Saru calls the bridge officer Mr. Rice.
Mm-hmm.
Why he called him Rice, I don't know, because they called him Reese for every other episode.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering about that too and question my own cognitive powers as to wow, have I just been getting this dude's name wrong the entire time?
Yeah, so that kind of took me out of the moment for a second there and hence my taking us out of the moment in this episode too, but the recap. But I thought that was kind of a strange one. But anyways, so Mr. Rice transports Book to his ship. The ship goes out and they are the Disco goes back outside the nebula. Book goes in, finds a pocket of safe space, and then comes back out. He is suffering from radiation burns, and he's pretty messed up. But he did manage to find this planet and a safe space for them to transport or spore jump into when they get their shields fixed back up. And they explain that, Book's going to be fine as he just needs some DNA recombination, which is a lovely way of saying we've cured cancer.
Yeah.
And it turns out when they do this analysis of the information that he brings back that the planet that is inside this nebula is almost entirely made up of dilithium, and they think that this could be the source of the burn. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
We cut back to our non-reversed, non-blue original credits, and then we come back to Admiral Vance. And Vance, they're looping him in. He's, a hologram, and he's on the ship, and he's sort of saying, what are you guys thinking? And Saru says, we got a mission. We're gonna jump in there. We're gonna beam down, and we're gonna try and rescue mission, and we're gonna try and figure out simultaneously if this is in fact the source of the burn. And Saru says, not only that, but I'm going. And Vance sort of looks at him sideways, and he says, no, I have faith in Ensign Tilly to be my number one while I'm gone. At that point, my rabbit ears immediately went up to this is gonna end so badly.
Yeah.
Like, that one was telegraphed. Like,
don't you remember Deanna Troi?
A million miles. Yeah, exactly right. She'll be fine. She's in charge. It's no problem. What's the worst that could happen? The ship will crash? So Tilly's chuffed. She's like, okay, I'm in charge. But, Vance gives him the data download that, hey, actually, I had to dispatch some of the Starfleet to Kaminar because there's been some more training exercises by the chain out there, because the Emerald Chain are trying to, lure lure the Discovery clearly into the field of combat because they now know about the spore drive and they know now that this is something that they want. So
wait, so how do they know about the spore drive? Did we use the spore drive last time we met with them?
I don't know if they would have seen them use the spore drive to leave, or if at this point we just assume that they have intelligence and that they put it all together. Okay.
So they mentioned in the episode that when they went to Quajan, I think is the name of the planet where Book is from.
Yep.
That the Emerald Chain had seen it happen. And even if they didn't literally see it happen on screen, they certainly saw, like, wait a minute, how come this Federation ship just arrived out of nowhere? Let's go there, sort of thing, right? And presumably they can scan from there of like, hey, they've got this weird chamber and this other chamber filled with other weird stuff too. Maybe they put two and two together.
Yeah, yeah. So then we get the information from, or who says it? Who's the first one? Is it Vance that says, I'm not sure you can be objective, or is it in that moment that that Burnham first says it, that they're not sure that...
No, she says it afterwards to Book, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then we get a scene between Stamets and Culber. Culber is going to go on the mission as well. Stamets is openly concerned, sort of saying, you know, no, don't go. Like, this is ridiculous. You don't need to go. And Stamets defends himself, sort of saying, you know, listen, not only am I the chief medical officer and I should go, but also I need to do this. You know, I was stranded. I was alone. I know what being isolated and abandoned feels like, and I have empathy for this child character, and I want to do this. And, you know, there's some ominous stage setting in that one, which we can discuss later too. We then go to Tilly and Burnham. You know, Burnham's getting all armored up and getting ready for her mission. She's going too, and Tilly is about to go take over the command, and they have a nice little exchange where, you know, Burnham explains that there's this factory defect on the captain's chair that has this little burr, this little spot that is, you know, a manufacturing mistake, and that Georgia used to press on it to sort of center herself when her mind was racing, and that Burnham says, I've used it too, and I've noticed that Saru does the same thing, just so you know it's there, that, you know, if you're having a tough time, you can use this burr. So then we go to them getting beamed out. So Saru, Culber, and Burnham are the away team. They're going to go inside. So they basically spore drive in, drop them off, and then spore drive immediately back out. And we've got Tilly at the con and not wildly confident in herself as she sits down. We cut back down to the planet that they beamed down to, or to where they beamed down to, which they thought was going to be aboard this ship. And they find themselves instead in a forest. And they're surrounded by snow and things are very weird. They are trying to figure out, well, did we end up on the planet? How could we have done that? And worse than that, or stranger than that, is that we get Burnham has suddenly become a Trill, Culber has become a Bajoran, and Saru is a human, which is a nice opportunity to actually get a look at Doug Jones for the, you know, short term. The man of a thousand faces, whose face we never actually see, gets to be himself for a whole episode. I also noted down that if it's Saru Man, he's Saruman for the Lord of the Rings heads out there. So they're trying to figure out what the hell's going on. They're like, okay, so we're on a holodeck. They try ending the program. No, it's not working. They encounter a glitchy hollow that's sort of trying to teach them a lesson about stuff, and it's sort of not working well. And they point out, well, you know, with giving all the radiation, it's amazing this thing is still functioning. And they sort of start exploring, trying to figure out, you know, where they are and trying to find a way out. And they find themselves at this huge sort of stepwell, this huge, you know, long sort of Harry Potter, M.C. Escher.
Escher, more like Escher.
Yeah, M.C. Escher kind of, you know, staircases that go up, down, sideways, and nowhere, and all sort of circling around this giant well, this giant sort of cavern in the middle of it. They are also, you know, overhead, they look up and there's these sort of flying creatures that look like maybe flying dragons, dragon fruit.
Which they don't mention, by the way.
Yeah, sort of a strange aesthetic going on there. They...
Like a lionfish sort of thing.
Yeah, they are exploring this area when they come across another character that they presume to be a hollow, and in fact it turns out to be the Kelpian that they're looking for, and he is surprised to see them and, you know, as frightened of them, and, you know, whoa, I gotta get out of here, and he takes off and he says, you know, you don't belong here and you woke the monster. And they realize that, you know, in spite of the fact that what they're looking at is clearly an adult male, that it's essentially a child, a childlike person, somebody who doesn't comprehend reality or the things that are going on around them. We go back to...
Well, he's been raised by YouTube, right? Like, yeah, we'll get to that.
Yes, that's
nothing
true.
Nothing but TikTok for that kid. They cut back to the disco, and we have the information that a Federation starship is approaching them. The crew is a little bit sort of confused, thinking, well, you know, we're sort of out here at the fringes of wild space. You know, how is that possible? And of course, your mind immediately starts to roll into, well, you know, I think we know what's coming. Back inside of the holodeck on the ship, the trio figure out that the holos had changed their appearance. They encounter this group that is supposed to be reenacting the scene where the Kelpians join the Federation. And it's sort of a history lesson, like a history class. But the history class is augmented enough that they can interact with this sort of main member of it, who sort of says, you know, are you the people who have come here to rescue this child?
Mm-hmm, right.
And that they realize, okay, well, you know, the reason why we all look the way we look is that it only knows a few forms and, you know, wanted to make sure that your forms were familiar. Now, given that two of them are already human, changing them into other things doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. I can see changing Saru, although even then, it's a Kelpian. You'd think a Kelpian would see a Kelpian. There are Kelpian holograms. That one didn't really sit with me. It just seemed like a way to make Sinequa Martin Green...
Have Doug Jones act like a human.
Yeah, have Doug Jones not have to put on the makeup for a week. Have the other two characters have to put on makeup for the week, you know?
Yeah, he did look pretty good as a Bajoran, I gotta say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it worked, but, you know, anyways. So they also, you know, are realizing that they're not alone in this place. There's this sort of weird monster, this sort of thing that's in there, this smoke monster, you know, getting Lost vibes from this one. What's with the smoke monster? And so they split up. Burnham is going to go is Burnham staying behind, right? She stays behind to investigate, you know, what's behind the door and try and keep this sort of smoke monster under wraps. And Culber and Saru are the ones that get this sort of data download. We then follow up with Burnham. Burnham is, you know, there. She's, you know, trying to figure out what this thing is. She sees it. It sort of comes after her. She runs. She's going through this sort of weird MC Escher world, and she falls. And she falls and falls and falls and falls and falls.
She falls up.
Yes. Yeah. She starts falling downward and then falls upward, which is bizarro. We cut back to Discovery, and Discovery quickly, you know, they're starting to put it together. They, you know, say, well, it doesn't make a lot of sense. There's no habitable planets around here. There's no way that this could be a Federation ship. Something's got to be off. And so they scan the area around the ship, and they realize it's, you know, just awash with neutrinos. There's no way that it isn't some sort of cloak. And sure enough, it's Osiris' ship. Back to the holodeck on the Kelpian ship. Burnham finds herself, you know, down at the bottom of the well, top of the well. I'm not sure how that worked out.
Yeah, she's at the top of the bottom. She's upside down.
Yeah, and
she's in the upside down.
That's right. And she is now interacting with the child, who is, of course, an adult. And he sort of says, you know, oh, you're a holo. You must be here to teach me a lesson. It's been a long time since I've seen a new holo. What are you supposed to teach me? And Burnham, realizing she has an opportunity, says, oh, yes, you're right. I am a holo. And I'm here to teach you about social interaction and what it's like outside. And so she starts sort of, you know, trying to, you know, understand.
Yeah, earlier in the show, Culber says we should treat this as a first contact.
Good point.
So she's doing her xenophobia or whatever, xenospecialist.
It's like xenoanthropology or something thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, the other two, Saru and Culber, are still trying to sort of explore and figure things out. They encounter a holo of an old Kelpian. And this is a really interesting moment for Saru, who, because he had left his culture to go off and explore the galaxy and eventually join Starfleet, and because he had gone back and freed his people, but that's only really happened in his near past, although in this world it's, you know, hundreds of years in the past. He's never seen an old Kelpian. And so that's a sort of a neat moment. He's kind of shocked at that. They find some information there, this book. The book explains that this child's name is Sukal, hence the title of the episode, and that Sukal roughly translates to beloved gift, that it would be a name that a family would give to a child that came following a tragedy. And so so the idea would be that he was born into this once they were already sort of stuck here. They also figure out that, you know, Dr. Issa clearly created all the Hollows, and that, you know, they are all there to sort of nurture this child and educate them and take care of him while he grows. Obviously not anticipating, you know, while the child is being to be rescued, not anticipating that it would take 120 years. We'll have to have a discussion about Kelpian lifespans at some point in here. So back to Burnham and Sukal, and they're having a conversation. He doesn't like some of the stuff that she's sort of saying. He starts sort of, you know, freaking out. She sort of says, you know, well, what do you know about, you know, do you have memories before you came into this world? Do you remember the outside? And he is starting to get really sort of wigged out by it. He's starting to get freaked out. She says, well, you know, where's the exit? How would you get out of here? And he says, you know, basically, you know, computer, restart the program. And she plays along and sort of does the, hello, I've restarted. They figure out that the totems, so this is Saru and Culber, figure out that the totems that they've been finding all over the place are similar to the totems that were created on the Kelpian planet, and that he's been building these little totems all over the place to try and protect himself from this monster, yeah. This sort of smoke monster, which Saru says is sort of
kelp
monster. Yes, absolutely, this kelp monster from mythology on their planet. And they end up connecting, and they end up going on these like Super Mario floating platform levels out towards this Bowser-esque castle. I was having a real, like, I'm, you know, 14 and playing Super Mario Brothers kind of vibe out of this whole thing.
Right.
They cut back to the disco, and Osyra starts a peeing contest with Tilly, where the two of them are just sort of, you know, throwing down on each other. Osyra sort of says, you know, hey, you're not Saru. What are you doing sitting there? And you know, Tilly says, you know, I'm the captain. I'm the acting captain. And Osyra sort of, you know, mocks her and says, you know, you're not the captain. You're going to get everybody killed. You have no idea what you're doing. Like, you know, you're a loser. And Tilly shoots back, and she puts out pretty tough and says, you know, oh, sounds like somebody, you know, there's a 19th century Earth psychologist that would have a little something to say about the term projecting here. You know, obviously you see a lot of yourself in these moments, and they have a little sort of, you know, exchanging barbs. They got back to the holodeck, and we end up with this encounter where the Sukal and the monster sort of are coming face to face, and we hear the monster utter "see me," which was kind of interesting. I don't know what the relevance of that was. The Sukal yells, he's freaked out, he's scared, and he yells, and there's this sort of cascade, this wave of energy that shoots across and sort of blasts and disrupts the holodeck to the point where you can actually see that it is inside, of course, the technology. And this blast wave sort of emanates right out of the Nebula, and it knocks out the cloak that is outside the Discovery and the cloak that is outside of Osyra's ship as well. Just as, you know, Sukal is really starting to freak out and things are getting really kind of escalated, Saru starts singing this lullaby that he had heard in that scene with the old Kelpian, and it is sort of lulling Sukal down. You know, it's calming him down. It's keeping him from things getting worse. The exchange between Osyra and Tilly continues now that they can both, you know, see one another, and there's sort of a level playing field. And Osyra sort of points out, you know, why haven't you jumped away? Why are you still here? You know, if I was this vastly outgunned and I had a ship that could just disappear, I would do that. I wouldn't just sit around. And then I think, oh, maybe you're waiting around for somebody. Maybe your captain is inside there. And they are at the same time, they're trying to build this, you know, the rescue mission. They're going to go in, they're going to save them. So Book is getting ready to launch his ship. He's got the radiation meds. He's sort of ready to go. He's going to go in there and he's going to try and pull them out. The second that Book basically launches his ship out, the invasion starts, and Osyra's forces start invading the ship. First, they take engineering. They grab Stamets. Then they're...
They jump right into the cube.
Yeah. And they grab him. They go and they start systematically getting the different parts of the ship, and eventually they take the whole thing.
The question is, how do they know how the spore drive works?
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on what future scanning tells them, right? Like, they could say what the heck is this.
Later on, they know how to control the spore drive, if you're...
Yeah, how do they know that Stamets is the key and everything else? Yeah, it's, that's to be revealed, I think.
I mean, it's not unreasonable given they could scan and see what the heck is with all these weird mushrooms in Discovery hull, or that's holding.
Well, maybe they read the upgrades that the Federation did on to improve, because Adira changes the way he interfaces, right?
And Adira knew immediately, oh, your little, you know, implants are related to activating the spore drive, right? So she sort of, they figured it out rather quickly. So I don't think it's unreasonable to think, hey, what's with this weird thing we scanned? Why does it send probe stuff, right? Yeah. For the Federation, or not Federation, I guess it was the Earth Defense Force or something that scanned. And then you could also have other people say, hey, there's this weird gel thingy. What does that have to do? Oh, maybe it has to do with this weird guy who presumably would still have some marks, even if they modified his implants, right? Mm-hmm. You'd still be able to tell that something was
there. Not in the future. They've got this, you know, they can cure cancer. I'm sure they can recombine his arm, whatever.
Yep. They diverted all the funds away from plastic surgery research over into cancer research.
Because they can't fix people's scars. Yeah, exactly.
So Book's inside the nebula. He has come to rescue them. They're reaching out. You know, he sort of explains the situation that Osira's there. They're getting ready to go. Saru basically says, no, I'm not going. I'm not going without this child. He needs to be saved. Culber says, I'm staying too. And so they say...
No, actually, it's the other way around. He says, I have to go and says, I have to go and I'm the captain. I have to go and
yeah, that's right. That's right. And Burnham says,
and you should stay.
You're never going to have your mind on the game. Right. You're right. And so Saru and Culber are staying. Burnham's going to go. So when Book gets within range, all of a sudden Adira pops out, and Adira basically says, you know, Reno gave me her transporter badge. I've got the meds. I'm going. And she poof beams down to the holodeck, and Burnham beams up. At this point, we get back to the disco. The bridge is taken. Osira shows up and sort of, you know, stares down Tilly. Tilly says, you know, she says, you know, get out of my captain's chair. Tilly says, you'll have to kill me. And she's like, I'm not going to kill you. I'm not getting blood all over my chair. And so they sort of hoist her out of the chair. She's sort of pushed off to the side. They, down in engineering, Stamets is trying to resist. They have this sort of, you know, zombification skull cap that they put on him. And his eyes go white. Theoretically, he's, you know, now in their power. And just as Book and Burnham emerge from the nebula, Discovery does its thing, black alert, and off they go. And that's the end of the episode, with Discovery gone, them stranded, Saru and Culber and Adira inside the nebula, the radiation being so bad in there that Culber basically says, if you can't come back and get us within a day, don't bother coming back, because we'll all be dead. And it's very Empire Strikes Back-y kind of ending.
Yeah. The first question I have, does Grudge live on Book's ship?
Yes.
Does Book live on Book's ship, or does he have like quarters?
He has sexy time with Michael on his ship, so I assumed that he treated his ship as the quarters.
Oh, that's right. He has the bedroom. Yes. Right.
Yeah, but that's pre deciding to, again, this is Neelix, right? This is pre deciding to join along on this merry adventure. So I don't know if he actually has assigned quarters now versus living.
Yeah, he's basically sleeping on the pod thing where they open the dock where they
the shuttle bay, the
loading dock, right? Shuttle bay. Yeah.
He's sleeping in the warehouse before
exactly.
Now that he's decided, again, very similar to Neelix, who had his own ship with Kes.
When he beams to his ship in the middle of the episode to go and rescue, to go and examine and find, scan this planet, does he also beam his cat over at the same time?
Oh, I guess he could.
You know, because you missed the scene where, you know, you didn't talk about the scene where he gets his DNA recombined, but they also have to recombine Grudge's DNA because she was also affected by the radiation on the planet.
Yes, that's true.
You know? Yeah. Anyway, just this is my first
question. Are you suggesting there's a cruelty to animals kind of thing going on in this episode?
No, do they not trust the cat to walk around on the Discovery? And, you know, like, does he like scratch all the fancy, you know, replicated furniture or something? And what's the deal?
They've already established in the previous episode that Reg has a predilection for hiding under things. I don't think you'd want to let her loose inside of a vessel and find out she's like hiding underneath the warp core or something, you know?
Yeah. So my second question, right? This is my turn to ask questions. We got a really cool shot of the Discovery, like as they were coming in on the episode. You had that sort of, you know, the inner, you have the outer, like, you know, the saucer section is actually two separate sections, right? Mm. And so you've got and they had the first time we've sort of seen that inner section up close to see, you know, how many windows it has and whatever. And I don't know if you've noticed, but like the first one is a ring that connects around at the back where it goes down to join the rest of whatever is down the bottom of the lower decks, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's like the inner ring, right? But the only place where they're joined is at the back of the ship. So how much would it suck if you lived in the front of the middle of the inner ring and had to go somewhere on the front of the outer ring?
Yeah.
That would be a long commute, right?
Well, not if you have the instant transporters now.
Well, but I mean, I'm thinking like, you know, like why didn't they build like a little bridge or a little, you know, entryway? It's kind of like, you know, it's bad ergonomic design. I mean, like think of the energy they're wasting by having people like jump in a turbo lift and get whipped around over there.
I had the same thought, Tim, but actually mine went a different way. Mine was, how crappy would it be if your room was the one facing the other side of the ring and not out into space like the people on the outer ring? Yeah. It's like the lower decks thing, right? Where they're like, we don't get a view. We don't get private quarters. We just all bunk it in here. We have to stare.
They're in a hallway.
We basically stare out at the other side of the ship, almost like pining for the nice life on the outer ring.
The only heavenly bodies I get to see are when the ensigns forget to blank out the windows. Just perving out.
Yes, that exact thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Those are my two questions for now. Well, three questions. I asked one earlier.
Yeah. So they sort of allude to the fact that, you know, Culber has a sort of speculative theory that, you know, well, maybe because Sukai is, you know, or Sukal is inside the nebula and that he's, you know, gotten used to the radiation because he's showing no signs of the radiation impairing him in any way, whereas the rest of them are quickly getting radiation burns and their health is deteriorating. You know, and then we see him, you know, he uses his voice and it creates this huge sort of, you know, burn effect. Are we safe in assuming that he is the source of the burn and that he's somehow got these sort of godlike powers that can, he's like become a dilithium Kelpian radiation monster?
Isn't that what Michael Burnham says in the middle of the episode, that he's the source of the burn, right? Because he's got this sort of weird power. Yeah. I mean, so are we going to get to the point in the episode where in the two shows where they won't be able to take him off the planet because he can't survive without the radiation, you know?
Yeah, I mean, who knows? And so I don't know if this is the resolution, if this is the mystery so far that we've been building to. This is the 11th of 13 episodes. Do you both feel like this is a satisfying answer for the mystery of what is the burn and how did it start? And
yeah, well, so I mean, yeah, because he has this sort of power that, you know, he's like the, I don't know if you ever say the Twilight Zone movie, there's like this kid that everybody's afraid of.
Yes, yeah.
You know, because he's got this, like everybody's like, you know, kowtowing to this kid and I don't know if it's Sarah Polly, but somebody like that is like, I don't understand why you're not, spanking this child. And turns out because he's got this, when he gets angry, you know, like tornadoes and, you know, hurricanes and fire and brimstone, right? Yep. So it's kind of like the same deal with Sukal, is that he's got this ability when he freaks out to sort of, you know, create this huge radiation. And, you know, the ship was trapped on the planet before, like many years before the burn, mm-hmm. right? So he triggered this sort of event that sort of, you know, knocks out the cloning on both starships that are orbiting and, you know, sends out this big giant shockwave. I think that, I guess where they're going with this, that he's, in fact, his rage or his angst is what's causing, was what caused the burn in the first place, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, he's got a, I don't know, it seems very TOS in its answer, right? Of like, yeah. This very weird, trippy thing is the root of cause of the problem. this child with a Skyrim Fusroda kind of power that like impacts everyone. So it's not where I expected them to go with it. I definitely wouldn't claim that. How it ends up feeling, I guess we'll see. I'm not opposed to it because I'm like, all right, you know, this is more less TNG and more TOS in its style of what does God need with a starship kind of answer is how I feel about it. It's not unreasonable. It'll be sort of interesting to see how that ends up impacting things. Like very clearly Saru is going to be very, very challenged by this whole thing, right? He's got to say, hey, like, you know, Kelpians became part of the Federation. Oh, I guess we became buddies with the Ba'ul as well. It's like, oh, wait, we were also the cause, accidentally, but the cause nevertheless of the burn will be, I think, and destroyed the Federation that he was very happy to join. Is going to be a very tough one for him to pick apart.
Yeah, I did also have a get off my lawn moment there where the scene where Michael Burnham is giving the sort of coaching to Tilly about taking over, and it's a sort of touchy-feely, you know, you can do this, I have faith in you, you're, you know, I'm behind you 100%, blah, 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 but I'm going to go to the planet for a couple of minutes, but you know, like, I'm like that whole sort of touchy-feely thing, that would never happen in TOS. Like,
no.
In TOS, they just beam down the planet and started, you know, kicking butt and, you know.
There would also be no spreading. Scene involving two women unless they were in bed with Captain Kirk, so that's
true.
Different.
That's also. True. That's true. Yeah, yeah, and it's true, and they were talking, again, it's that sort of Bechdel test, too. They weren't talking about how is this going to affect some man in their lives, right? They were talking about how they dealt with it and how Philippa Georgiou, who is also a female, dealt with it, right, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And that Saru also. I thought it was interesting, the story about the little imperfection on Philippa Georgiou's ship, where by the time Burnham got to sit in the chair, the little sharp thing had been, you know, rubbed down to a nice smooth spot, right?
Yeah.
A dent, in fact, right? So she stressed out on it so much, right?
Yeah.
And you didn't really mention it, but there was a couple of times where Tilly reaches for that little button, and it seemed more like a rivet to me than it was a severe imperfection if they let that through quality control, you know?
It's not subtle. It's a pretty big manufacturing error, so.
Exactly.
Somewhere those little robots aren't doing their jobs.
Yeah. They do mention the bots in this episode too, fixing things.
Yeah.
Fixing Book's ship, right?
Yeah. It was a weird episode. I felt like it kind of was easy to spot the direction everything was going, you know?
Really?
Not so much the plot about Sukal, but the plot with the whole Osira and the, you know, Tilly being in charge and, oh, what could go wrong if Saru leaves the ship? Like, you just don't say stuff. Like, it's just, I thought that was a little poorly telegraphed, that portion.
Or did you think that Osira would show up and take the steel
100%.
Ship?
100% at about 4 minutes into the episode.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, Xavier asked me at the end of the episode, sir, what did you think? And I said, you know, because I made a point of saying to him midway through the episode, like, oh, this is going to happen and this is going to happen. And he was just like, shut up. I was like, okay.
Yes, manna from my own heart.
Yeah.
So I did like the fact that they sort of used the holodeck, which is something that we got out of the TNG, right? But I like the fact that they used that the mother had set up this holodeck to protect her child, right? I mean, there's sort of no exposition as to how long she would have had to set this whole thing up, because she, you know, she apparently had prepared a bunch of programs, like so many, so that this adult now. Oh yeah, and that's another point, another question I have. But yeah, the fact that, you know, she could create this little nest for this youngling to be raised in, right? With all these, and he'd watched all the shows on YouTube, and he was like, "Where did you come from? I don't recognize this. I've not seen this show before," sort of thing, right? And the fact that the technology is breaking down over time. I don't know. I don't necessarily think it has to do with radiation, what they said, but, you know, just things wear out or edge cases weren't planned in the programming. So what I want to know is I don't know how long Kelpians live,
but
how did this guy live 125 years? One, why doesn't he look like the old timer? Two, and because Saru's never seen anybody over 45 or something, right?
Yeah.
Because they all get culled when they hit maturity, right? Yeah, the Varai. Yeah. Yeah. How is he alive? And how come the radiation didn't? I mean, like they said, maybe he got used to it when he was in utero or whatever. But
yeah,
how is he still alive?
It feels like a little bit of Star Trek explaining, you know, where they sort of give you a little techno goobity goob, and you have to sort
babble.
Of assume that that is in fact the case. It, to me, I didn't find it a very.
And where does he get food from for 125 years?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't look like there was just the sort of replicator that spat out food for him there. I don't know. There's a few holes that you could drive this through again. I don't want to get too down on it. I am enjoying the season so far. I don't want to sort of pick it to shreds, but at the same time, there's some holes in this.
But I was saying though, it was an interesting way to explain how possibly that this being could be kept, you know, sustained for so long. You know, just plug them in front of the iPad and put on YouTube and let it play on repeat, right? You know, that's kind of how this kid was raised, right?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a commentary there on our lifestyles and how we're raising our children and all kinds of good stuff in there. Yeah.
At least he doesn't have, I mean, he must be an Apple product because he doesn't have to sit through ads all the time, right?
It would have been awesome if one of the characters just turned to him and said, try new, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. You know? I've never actually sat down and watched Being there, but that apparently is also a Peter Sellers character who was raised completely on television, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Same sort of idea, right?
Yeah.
What do you think, Jaime?
Yeah, I'm going into spoilers territory here, but looking at the titles that we can see now for episode 12 and 13, I can kind of see that this is a three-part finale for the season, is what it feels like.
If we can believe it, because they did change the title of this show just before.
Right. So you're right. Given what we know now, as it currently stands, 11 is Sukal, 12 is Good of the People, 13 is Outside. Good of the People, I could see being like, all right, we can't let Osira have the disco and this dilithium planet. Like, maybe we might have to like blow up the planet and kill the child. We may also have to destroy the Discovery and make sure that this technology isn't in your hands, right? Yeah. That could be a for the good of the people question. Like, we have to sacrifice ourselves.
Yeah, I kind of glossed over that, but it's worth mentioning, Jaime, and you make a really good point. There is one point in the episode where Tilly sort of says, you know, you can go ahead and take the ship, but I will blow it up. You know, like, she's pretty adamant.
Everybody looks at her.
Yeah, and Owo sort of turns around and gives her an eye of like, sorry, what now?
I mean, and that's an old trope from Star Wars, Star Trek 2, because Kirk was constantly threatening to destroy the Enterprise when he got into a jam, right?
Mm.
And he said, my toys and you can't have them, right?
Yeah.
And the 13th episode is currently titled Outside, which is what the child has been referring to as the outside of his hollow ship.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that freaks him out because when they say outside, he doesn't know what that means, right?
Yeah, because he's basically been the equivalent of having grown up in like a 1960s bunker underground, you know, that the parents thought that the war had happened, the nuclear war had happened.
Yeah, what was that movie with that guy?
Those are my favorite Timisms. What was that movie with that guy?
There was a movie from
the movie is called Blast 90s. From the Past.
Okay.
Yeah, 90s, the guy 2000s. Who went to Upper Canada College, right? From The Mummy. What's his name?
Brendan Fraser.
Yeah. And Steve, I think, is it Steve Martin, his father or something
like that?
Christopher Walken, right?
Yeah. he's raised in this bomb shelter. Sissy Spacek's his mom and Christopher Walken's his dad. And they raise him and educate him in this thing. And then they send him out one day for, you know, I can't remember if it's medicine or some supply. And he encounters the modern world and, you know, sort of is like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Not a classic, but not a bad watch.
But interesting though, like that now Star Trek has entered into this sort of this realm of what happens if you raise your kid on YouTube, right? So, or TikTok, even worse.
Yeah. Well, it's the 10-second attention span, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't like this episode. I want to watch something else, right?
Yeah.
Like, I have a 5-year-old that does that, right?
Yeah. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how this evolves. Obviously, this whole season has been building to this, you know, the mystery, what is the burn?
Yeah.
The mystery, you know, has been sort of getting enriched over the past few episodes with these sort of inside those two Emperor Georgiou episodes, having the sort of, you know, oh, it's the nebula. What's inside the nebula? Okay, it's the ship. Okay, oh, it's Kelpian ship. You know, Saru's investment, the whole nine yards. It will be interesting to see how this sort of continues to play forward. It does look like next episode will be sort of the, you know, the uprising against the takeover of the ship. It'll be the, you know, sort of everything you'd expect. Everything we've seen in previous, the ship's been taken over episodes of any kind of Star Trek or sci-fi kind of thing, right?
Yeah, it's interesting that from a perspective of how modern television shows are going, I mean, like that you've got, like it seemed to be that in every episode we've had so far, there's always been some sort of problem that they've managed to solve it in 45 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. And yet there's also these long arcs that run over time. And, you know, you get shows like The Walking Dead where it just constantly goes on and on and on, and there's never any end in sight. I mean, there's glimmers of hope, but there's no cure, there's no whatever solution. And then you get shows like this where you have a season-long arc that gets solved. Like, we know we're going to find out what the burn is. How many episodes are we in? This is what?
11 of 13.
The 11th, yeah. Right? So how many do we have?
Two more?
Yeah, so we know by the 13th episode, we're going to know what the cause of the burn was. Like, that's, you know, like we knew what the Red Angel was, and we knew, you know, I forgot what season one was about. What was season one about?
What was the Lorca twist, right?
The Lorca thing, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we know that's going to get solved, and then they'll have to set something up for next year, but, you know, it's interesting that television has sort of become this way, as opposed to just like the, you know, the sitcom sort of, you know, 25-minute cycle, you know, of things that go on, right? It's interesting, like, because I mean, like, you know, now you get to be like Jaime and sit down and watch Mandalorian from beginning to end as one big long movie, whereas you and I have to sit through an entire, you know, 8 weeks to see what happens, right?
Yeah, and it's 8 weeks times two spread over 2 years too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I can't decide. Sometimes I enjoy binging things. You know, there are some things where it's very satisfying to sort of have that next episode, the sort of Netflix model of, you know, hey, here it all is, enjoy it at your own pace. Sometimes I find it daunting because, especially if it's, you know, hour-long episodes and they're doing, you know, 13, 15 episodes, it is overwhelming. You can't really get through it, and then you feel like you're kind of racing against the rest of the world. And it does diminish. I will say this for the Star Trek model and for the model that some other platforms are choosing of going out weekly, there is more of a connectivity. It's not quite the same as Sunday at 9 o'clock on HBO. That's the glamour spot, right? That's where you get your Game of Thrones. That's where you get your Westworld. That's where you get these premier television event kind of things.
Yeah, it used to be Thursday at 8 as well, right?
Was there a
spot? Seinfeld spot?
Yeah, or Cosby Show or Cheers or whatever those shows are, right? The ones that really the whole world crystallizes around. And in the modern era, there have been very few of those things that have really been like appointment watching in that way, everyone's experiencing it simultaneously. Everyone's experiencing the same sort of...
Well, Mandalorian's been like that though, right?
But even then, you know, I think we talked about it in a previous episode. I do have people in my life who are in other continents and still not quite the same. You know, it drops at 3 a.m. or midnight, basically Pacific time, and wherever you are in the world, it affects you that way, right? I find like there is something to be said for that sort of connected feeling, that, you know, shared experience.
We're all experiencing it at the same
time. Well, the same thing we talk about going to the movies, right? Is that at the very least, if you go to see the movie at the first time, but even then, you know there's a show after yours, you know that there's more people watching it that weekend, so you don't go online and spoil it or anything else. You know, Game of Thrones, one of the most interesting experiences of that was the intersection of appointment television with social media, where people would watch the episode and immediately go online and start trading ideas and theories and comments or people would be doing it in real time too. People would be like, oh my god, can you believe what happened with that effing dragon?
But did Game of Thrones come out at the same time for everybody
time of day? It's a good question.
Mandalorian does that. I can sit down and watch Mandalorian at lunchtime on Friday, but you know that the people who are watching are gonna go watch it on Friday, right? Kind of thing, right?
Yeah,
when it rolls out.
Game of Thrones did premiere at the same time, whether East Coast or West Coast of North America. I know that for sure because I used to listen to a live recap show where they talked about theories and everything else that went on the air at like 10:05 or 5 minutes after the episode ended. They went live on Twitter.
Eastern, yeah.
So whether it was 9 a.m. or 9 p.m. Eastern time, it was clearly on or available at 6 p.m. on the West Coast, because then everybody was watching at the same time.
Well, let's do this. Let's slide right into the watch list, because I'm going to roll this conversation piece into the watch list and just jump into my second and third point was that I just wanted to catch up that I had watched watched Disenchanted. And I just finished watching the second part two, episode 10, just today, mm-hmm. right? And we talked about that one. Like, and now I have to wait, you know, a couple of weeks to get the next season. Mm-hmm. But, and I also watched, which we talked about last week, Christmas movies that made us, right? And what's interesting about that, and I also mentioned Amazing Stories on iTunes or Apple TV, yeah. What do you call yep. it? Apple TV Plus. The Christmas movies that made us, there's only two episodes so far.
Yeah.
Right? Does that mean there's only two episodes altogether? Because, I mean, there's tons of movies they could delve into, right? You know, and so I'm kind of wondering, like an Amazing Stories, I mentioned last week that I had seen three episodes, but I was flipping by Apple TV the other day looking for something to watch, and I noticed that there are actually five episodes now, so I've got two more to go back and catch up. But it seems to be now that they're not just dropping all the episodes at once in these different formats. I mean, Apple's been doing this where they release on Fridays, they release new episodes for shows that they make, right? Much like Disney's doing, right? But which kind of like makes your Friday like just chock full of things to watch, right? It'd be nice if they spread it around a bit, right? But I think, are we moving away from this drop all the episodes at once kind of vibe and getting into the sort of like get you hooked and then have you come back, you know, when the next episode drops kind of thing, right?
I don't think there's a right answer. I really do think it...
Well, I think they're playing with it, for sure.
Yeah. And I think that it's fair that, like, and there's criticisms about both. You know, the challenge is, you know, again, if you drop 13 episodes of a must-see TV kind of thing like Stranger Things, it does kind of skew the experience. You aren't having those sort of shared...
Yeah, yeah.
And also, it's good for the brands. I think what these broadcasters, whether it's traditional or streaming services, are learning is you can put this stuff out there week in one big dump, but then the conversation about that comes and goes in like a week and a half, 10 days, tops. That's stretching it. Whereas if you do week by week by week by week with things like Mandalorian, Game of Thrones, you know, insert program here, if you do these week after week, drops, The Boys did that for Amazon Prime.
Right.
Yeah. The conversation continues and the momentum builds, it seems. Like people are, oh, you saw, did you see episode one? Oh, it was really good. You should see episode one. Oh, okay. And then more people sort of, it starts to snowball, right? I do think that there is, I'm sure, incredible amounts of research. You guys must know this, obviously, better than I do, but the kind of, you know, algorithms that you write into viewing habits and how your users are interacting with your platform and everything, they must have a reason. There's no way that Netflix just arbitrarily does it for no good reason, but I think it's probably better for the brand to do week by week by week. Yeah. I mean, think about what Disney is doing with their plans they've announced, right? They just wrapped Mandalorian last week. They're taking off like a 3-week break, which is covering pretty much the winter holidays. So, you know, a lot of the stuff falls in there. And then they're coming back in January with WandaVision, their Vision and the Scarlet Witch series.
Right.
That's going to run weekly, just like Mandalorian did, and it's going to basically go week. As soon as it ends, I don't know if it's the next week or if there's a week hiatus, but then it goes right into Falcon and the Winter Soldier. When that ends, it goes straight into Loki. They haven't announced what comes after that, but essentially what they're doing is programming you that every Friday you have to be there. So you have to keep your subscription, Jaime, sorry. You have to keep your subscription because they want you to be there every single week. They want you to feel you're getting value every single week for your product, but they're also saying, hey, I have to check in with Disney Plus every week, and then we're going to be talking about it, and we're going to be talking about all their different products in a non-stop way. That's smart. That's super smart. In a way that I think continues, like, I love Stranger Things. I think it's been a great program. I've really enjoyed the work that they've done on it. But between seasons, I never think about it.
Not me
at too. All. And, yeah. and it's no disparagement to the quality of the program. It's no disparagement to the performers, the show creators, or anything else. Yeah. All it is that when the show comes out, I would say I hardcore binge it, but I'll probably watch it over the course of a week. I'll watch the whole thing.
You probably watch two or three episodes a night.
Sure.
You kind of get through it. And that, I mean, to me, and that kind of sullies the experience because you kind of binge through three or four episodes. You don't really have time to digest the middle one or the first one, right? Yeah. And I think that's, so what the boys did this year was, I'm sure they had all eight episodes in the can. They released two of them to get you started, mm-hmm. right? And then they just won, and I was there every week when it dropped to watch it, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that, to me, that's a better formula. I guess the question is, like, how much faith do you have in those first two episodes that you're going to actually create an audience, right? You know, the boys, they didn't do that for the boys first season. I think the first season, did they drop them all at once?
Dropped them all at once.
So they had the audience, they had the return audience coming for season two, right? Such a good show, but interesting. I just thought it was interesting that Disenchanted, I mean, I've been flipping by it. It's been out for 3 years now, I guess, right? Like, did that one drop all at once?
Yes.
And so in January 10th or whenever it's coming out, we'll get part three. And interesting, they're not calling it season three, right? They're calling it part three, right? Yeah. So
It's interesting the way that the different services are choosing. And again, I think it's really interesting because the story behind Netflix is that they have sort of been reticent to give out numbers over the years, right? They don't want to talk about their audience. They just say, oh, this one did really well. Oh, this one's canceled. Mm-hmm. They don't really get too far into it, but it was interesting to see the way that they're doing that way.
Right.
You know, they must have a method to it that says, you know, if we drop it all at once, we get the numbers that are satisfying for us in the way that they're satisfying for us, and therefore we go forward, right?
Yeah. Anyway. All right. Well, speaking of watching things, I'm going to do my second pick now. We've talked about this on the show before, but this is an interesting post, and I can't remember. This is one of the ones that I was talking about before we started recording today. I posted some things and then they disappeared on me on our Google Notes, which I, you know, wasn't sure about. But I went and found, I just did a Google search and I found this particular link. So I don't know if this is the same one I was talking about before, but what I am talking about is how to watch Star Wars movies in order. And this is something interesting for, there are, believe it or not, I don't know if you know this or not, John, but there are people who've never seen Star Wars. I'll let that sink in for a minute.
Anyway. Are they better than us or worse than us? I can't decide.
I don't know. Like, but I do know people who have never seen it before. But anyway, so there's this page, and I'm going to have a link in the show notes for folks, is really cool because it's got Star Wars in chronological order, and it's the order in which they're numbered, right? So you have Episode 1, The Phantom Menace, which actually was 32 years after the original movie, and you watch these all in reverse order. My problem with watching them in chronological order is the state of the art of movie making. You know, I still think A New Hope, I've always said A New Hope is an amazing movie, and so is Empire Strikes Back, but they're very much movies from the 70s and 80s, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of style. So anyway, so you can watch them, you know, from Episode 1 to Episode 11, which is Rise of Skywalker, right? And now they're calling that the Skywalker saga, mm-hmm. right? You can watch them in release order, which is the order in which Jonathan and I watched them, you know, A New Hope, all the way up to, you know, taking that 32-year break or whatever it was, and or it was 17-year break, I think, between Return of the Jedi and Phantom Menace, right?
So it was 83 to 99, 16
99
years.
99 to 83, yeah.
16 right? years.
16, felt like 17 years. Anyway, and then going and standing in line for, I mean, I think since Phantom Menace came out, I've been standing in line on day one for all of these movies, right? Well, we don't stand in line anymore, but...
Now we queue up to get our tickets on the day they go on sale.
Yeah, and then there's this new one, which is the Ultimate Star Wars Viewing Order, including Mandalorian and Clone Wars.
Oh, Lord.
Right. So, yeah, so you've got, you know, Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones, the Clone Wars animated series, the Clone Wars animated movie. I didn't know the movie came before. Oh, I've been skipping the movie thinking it came afterwards.
They debuted it in the theater. It was the, it came out in the theater as a big launch to the series. I don't know if you've had a chance to watch it. It's not a great movie.
I watched
movie.
The first part of it, and then I realized it was the movie, not the show, and so I stopped watching it. So I should go back and watch it?
It's a good setup. It explains some of the stuff that you need to know for Clone Wars, like where they got that weird ship and some other stuff. It's the first introduction to Ahsoka, so good stuff.
So, and you all the way through Revenge of the Sith, and then the Solo, A Star Wars Story, jammed in the middle of that. Mm-hmm. The Rebels animated series, which Jonathan loves. And then you get to Rogue One, which dovetails into New Hope. I'm kind of cringing at that thought. And then, you know, then you've got Return of the Jedi, Mandalorian, and then you've got Resistance animated series. Is that new?
Resistance comes right before the Force Awakens, and it's the most familiar character in there is Poe Dameron. It's basically about the Resistance against the First Order after the First Order starts to come. So it's basically the creation of the second rebellion. It's basically Rebels Part 2.
Right, right. And well, and it's also, so is that, like, when did that come out? I don't know.
3 years ago? 4 years ago?
Okay, so...
yeah, it's all on Disney Plus 2.
Okay, cool. Which is good for Jaime. He can binge all this stuff in the next
couple of weeks. Assuming he doesn't sleep for the next month.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's the famous Machete Order, which is, you know, all the way through. And I think this is the one where you skip out... There's one movie
episode
you skip
one, here, The Phantom Menace is what you skip out on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you watch because of 4, 5, 2, 3...
And do you fast forward through all the Jar Jar Binks stuff?
I mean, God. Honestly, the Jar Jar part is not nearly as bad as the dialogue between Padme and Anakin in episode 2. Yes. But yeah, you're supposed to watch 4, 5, 2, 3, 6.
So I think I told you that I went and saw Star Wars in 3D at the IMAX, right? Mm-hmm. Which was a special it was Phantom Menace, right? And it was a special thing. I still have the glasses with the, you know, logo on the side. But anyway, they skipped the waterfall scene with those big sort of potato bugs or whatever, that potato animals that Anakin rides on. I think they skipped it just because, like, I think back then they used to think you can't watch an IMAX movie for a very long time, right? Now, of course, you know, they put 3-hour movies on IMAX all the time, right? But yeah, but I think back then it was like, you know, the human brain can only handle 40 minutes of IMAX or something like that. And then there's now there's a new one here called Disney Movies. Oh, it's got all this thing about stuff on Disney Plus as well. And then there's a ranking of the movies in order, based on what? What's it based on? Oh, IMDb scores. Mm. So Empire Strikes Back is number 1, New Hope is number 2, Return of the Jedi is number 3. Interesting. And then all the way down to Phantom Menace being the least liked one. Mind you, not by much. 6.5 out of what? And Attack of the Clones is the second last one. Why did you say woof? What?
Oh, dear Lord. Attack of the Clones is so much worse. God, that movie is... It is.
I think we talked about that.
It is 20 minutes of good Ewan McGregor wrapped around two bowls full of barf. It is horrible. That is a horrible movie. That was the one where someone needed to have just taken George aside and said, let someone else punch up the dialogue.
So here's what's interesting about this is that Rise of Skywalker is the third least liked movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Really?
Oh, Rise of Skywalker. Oh, no, that's the new one, right? That Rise of Skywalker is the sucked. It sucked. You know it sucked. Come on. Oh, I'm not dying alone on this hill. There are plenty of there with me.
I mean, there's three contenders there: Rise of Skywalker, Attack of the Clones, and The Phantom Menace. All vying for the. If this is a sports team, they'd all be vying for the number one draft pick.
Right? Yeah.
Well, so they've got Force Awakens as number 4 on this list. With Rogue One being number 5.
All right. In the spirit of Christmas giving, I would like to hear both of you rank this, and I'll give you mine too. Give me your Star Wars rankings, top to bottom.
Oh, I'd have to think about it, but for sure. For me, it's you know, it's the reverse order. It's New Hope and then Empire Strikes Back. Yeah. I liked Force Awakens. I liked Last Jedi. I liked Rise of Skywalker. You know, I'd probably put Rogue One somewhere in there. Revenge of the Sith. That's the one where Darth Vader becomes Darth Vader, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
The one that I was complaining about.
Yeah, that's the checklist.
I'm gonna move that one down my list because I you know. So here's the thing: if these things were on TV, I would stop and watch them in like the ones I just mentioned, right? I would stop and watch these ones. Revenge of the Sith, I might watch part of it. Last Jedi, I definitely would watch. Solo, I've watched a few times now. Rise of Skywalker, I would watch. And I mean, I own these movies too. Like, that's the other thing too, is like, you can, now they're, even though they're on Disney, I do own these movies, right? Attack of the Clones, no, I think I'd probably pass on that one, except I like the Ewan McGregor stuff, like I mentioned, right? I like the big guy in the diner too. I like him. Phantom Menace, I like Qui-Gon Jinn, so I'd probably watch that one, right? So, and I like the Bic Army, right? I've always been a fan of the droid army, right? So, what do you call it? Battle droids, right?
Yeah, but then you get 20 minutes of Jar Jar accidentally winning a battle by being a dork too, which is woof.
That's for the kids, man. He's annoying in that movie, but but again, I also weighed against the 17 years I had to wait, because that's my, I'm going to shut up now. Jaime's going to give you his ranking.
So looking at their ranking, I think The Empire Strikes Back is a better, has the right way of putting this. It's probably a better movie in terms of, like, oh, given the knowledge that you have, I think if I'm going to rank them, it suffers by being not the first movie and therefore really, really having to struggle to explain a whole bunch of things. It just assumes you know A New Hope. So I'm putting A New Hope number one because it is the one that if no other film happened, those would all still make sense, right? Mm-hmm. So I put A New Hope number one, very close tie to Empire Strikes Back. I don't remember what I said on the show before. It's probably closer to The Force Awakens. I think I put Return of the Jedi next, and I think I bump Rogue One above The Force Awakens in terms of rewatchability, like just literally when they're on TV, which they're on TV a lot now during the pandemic.
Yeah, well, what's good about Rogue One is it's not part of the sort of Skywalker saga stuff, yeah. Right? Like that's what I like about it. It had a fresh sort of perspective.
It's largely self-contained, even though it kind of leans a little bit on like you kind of know where this is going, right? But it doesn't stray too far into it. I think The Force Awakens is pretty solid as sort of a reboot almost of A New Hope. Looking at the rest of this list, I'm probably going to watch The Last Jedi more often than I'll sit and watch Revenge of the Sith. So that one's still feeling okay there. Solo, yeah, I'd probably watch that. And then I think I would watch Attack of the Clones more than I would The Rise of Skywalker or The Phantom Menace. I'm having a real hard time choosing between The Rise of Skywalker or The Phantom Menace to be the next to last. So I'm unclear there.
You would put Rise of Skywalker last.
Or possibly Phantom Menace. I'm having a real hard time choosing between the two.
Really?
Welcome aboard, Jaime. We're glad to have you here on the mountain.
It's tough. So it almost argues for like a new Machete order, which they claim, to continue watch the sequel saga. It's like, no, you're not following the same principle here, right? The principle was, so you don't watch Episode One, The Phantom Menace. You watch A New Hope and then The Empire Strikes Back to maintain the Luke, I am your father story. Then you go back in time to see Darth Vader for Attack of the Clones, Revenge of the Sith. Normally, you'd go to Return of the Jedi, but I say, no. Remove Return of the Jedi from there. Put The Force Awakens, The Last Jedi, so that you come in, you're like, dude, what the heck happened? What happened to Palpatine's? Oh, mystery. Then you see Return of the Jedi, then you see The Rise of Skywalker, so that you have the last two scenes of Palpatine being, thrown down the pit, and also coming back like the very next movie as a real WTF moment.
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, they didn't have to have Palpatine come back in Rise of Skywalker. They could have come up with something else. They could have had the Darlok for all that matter.
So lame, so badly conceived, so badly executed, so bad. That movie is
all right. So terrible. What's your order, Mr. Star Wars?
All right, so for the sake of this conversation, I will omit the two Ewoks films. I will omit the Clone Wars.
There's two Ewok films?
Ewok films, both of which were full-length films, but were made for television. There was the Ewok Adventure and Ewoks : The Battle for Endor, both of which are horribly bad. There is the cinematically, you could include the Clone Wars movie since it did come out in theaters, but I won't for the purposes of this. I will focus on the 9 Skywalker films and Clone Wars, and Rogue One and Solo. So my order is Empire, A New Hope, Rogue One, Last Jedi. Ugh, it's like getting rotten eggs.
Well, I did toot a little while ago.
I guess. Upon multiple views, I just don't like a lot of these. I guess it would probably be Revenge of the Sith. Boy, this is a breakfast burrito filled with barf.
Yeah, but the Revenge of the Sith got that lame fight between Obi-Wan and Anakin Skywalker, and then at the end of it, the Emperor basically reprograms Darth Vader and has him on the bed coming up like Frankenstein.
That whole sequence towards the end of the movie sucks, but it's the same. It has the same strength.
And then the instant birth and death of Padme. I mean, give me a break. Yeah,
but it does have the really good scenes with Ewan McGregor. Ewan McGregor is the strength of those scenes. Throughout. The scenes with him where he's off chasing Grievous, and they do focus on him a little more, and there is some good space battle stuff. That first fight scene where the two of them are in the ships and then they crash and they get into Grievous's ship or into Dooku's ship and they fight with him, and that I like that part's not bad.
No, that's what I mean. But what I'm saying about this is my checklist movie. Like there was 30 minutes left and George Lucas said, oh crap, I've got to get all this stuff in.
No, you're right. It's really forced through the whole thing, and that makes it unfortunately predictable. The only things that are the wild cards are the scenes with Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah. Admittedly, anything he's been in is great. Yep.
From there, I guess I've got to choose between Rise of Skywalker, Force Awakens, Attack of the Clones, The Phantom Menace, and Solo. So I would probably say Solo is probably better than those. Although, I like the performances. I didn't think Alden Ehrenreich was bad. I just found that that was, again, exactly what you're describing, Tim, was playing the hits. I enjoyed Force Awakens because, again, I liked the performances and I thought it was good. I just thought it was really derivative. It was basically a not as good copy of New Hope. So that would be my next one. I think that leaves me with Rise of Skywalker, an Attack of the Clones, and Phantom Menace. I would probably choose Phantom Menace because I enjoy Liam Neeson and Ewan McGregor, and the fight scene between them and Ray Park's Darth Maul is fantastic.
Yeah,
that makes the movie. The John Williams score and them fighting for like 15 minutes is really good.
Well, you forgot about the young kid blowing up the space station thing.
This is pod racing. Kill me. Anyways, the last two, it's down to Rise of Skywalker and Attack of the Clones, and Rise of Skywalker is a convoluted, badly made mess that speaks to the huge deficiency in J.J. Abrams' ability to finish what he starts, right. But it's still a better movie than Attack of the Clones, because that is, at times, right. It is turn off the television and leave the room bad. There are some scenes in that. There are some scenes that are fantastic. You're right. The whole part with Ewan McGregor where he's going to Kamino and he's sort of unraveling the mystery and all. That part's really watchable. And then they cut to the Padme and Anakin stuff and you're like, this is the worst B-movie claptrap I've ever seen. It is horrible.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question. So if you have these nine movies and the three or four Transformer movies, now how do you rate them?
Ooh, yeah. No, they're better than the Transformers. I mean, so we should circle back to the same point that I think we've made multiple times on these shows, which is any Trek is good Trek, any Star Wars is good Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like the worst that it gets is still pretty darn watchable stuff. You know, I will always be able to find parts of it that I really enjoy. I love the imagination that goes into it. I found my biggest problem with the latest trilogy was it just had no cohesion. The part of what's Mandalorian has been so good is we've had two people that are really headlining the whole thing. It's Jon Favreau and it's Dave Filoni. And these guys have a vision and they're working the vision.
Yep.
And maybe they are getting a lot of notes and maybe there is a lot of by committee stuff in there too. I don't know. But it really feels like there's a cohesive sense of where it started and where it's going. The problem I had with the Force Awakens, Last Jedi, Rise of Skywalker trilogy is that they tried to sort of set something up and then they undid parts of that and then they went back and they undid parts of that and they kept sort of bringing in old ideas and trying to mix in new ideas and sort of backtracking over the stuff they'd just done a couple of years ago. How in this modern era, how in this world do you not get that right? Like it just does to me. I think honestly, my anger at Rise of Skywalker is more that I feel like in this era when we see so much good television and so many good movies and cohesiveness to all these things, it just feels so haphazard. And it's really more that it's just disappointment. I really wanted it to be a new place to go. I wanted it to be something fun. I wanted it to be more than it was. It's not anger. It's disappointment. It's extreme disappointment. There was plenty of stuff. I think, you know, Rey is a great character. I think Finn is a great character. I think Poe Dameron's a great character, but none of it all worked together. And I think the whole, this character is in love with this character, but this character is not in love with this character. And none of that resolves. And the Emperor came back. We're not going to tell you how, why, or like, how do you not go into this with an overarching, hey, we're making a trilogy, this is what it's going to be about, this is how the trilogy starts, this is what the middle part does, and this is how the end does. How do you have Rian Johnson write a completely separate movie from what JJ did and then have JJ come and undo it? Like, how do you do that? That's just so weak.
Yeah.
All right. I'm putting my soapbox away. It's Christmas.
Yeah. So you guys haven't watched the Christmas movies that made us thing yet, right? Because holiday movies, I guess it's called, right? Because I'm curious to see what you guys think about the Nightmare Before Christmas. I just watched that this afternoon and I was surprised by some of the things in it. Anyway, let's move on to Jaime and his pick.
Yeah, my pick, because our household just recently watched Tenet because we got it from a, I think we had a coupon to use at Redbox So we used it on Tenet, which had just come out on DVD or Blu-ray. And enjoyable movie. Good movie. Long movie, 2.5 hours. And I found this video from Cracked, the former comedy magazine, now comedy website, where they have remade Tenet for only $20. So spoilers, if you haven't seen the movie, it's 3 minutes and 23 seconds of them parodying the major scenes for the movie. It's pretty entertaining, probably more so if you've actually seen the movie. I recommend giving it a watch.
All right,
cool. All right,
John. I got a couple. One's an obvious one. Wonder Woman's coming out. I think all three of us are keen to see if, you know, after this one being delayed so much.
Only curious to see it come out and see the light of day.
I am, but it feels like because it has been this sort of moving target for so long, there has been this expectation built around it. I don't know how it lives up to that. So
yeah, that's what worries me. Is it going to be a lunch bag?
Yeah, I've seen a couple of headlines on reviews. The Times did a review today and a few other places that have obviously put reviews out. I'm a little concerned that people will judge it unfairly against the backdrop of the pandemic and how they had to view it and. I'm going to try and go in with as open in mind as I can. I enjoyed the first picture. I thought it was really well done. I thought Gal Gadot was really good. And I like Kristen Wiig very much. And I'm curious to see what she does as the villain. I'm going to try and keep an open mind. But that one's definitely on my to-do list over this, between this episode and our next episode. The other one I wanted to mention was, as I've been trying to watch a few movies since I'm now on vacation, I watched Palm Springs, which came out earlier this year on Hulu in the United States and just came here to Canada on Amazon Prime here in Canada. And I put this one in here because it does actually kind of fall into our milieu of the podcast. It is a bit of sci-fi. The idea of it is that it stars Andy Samberg from Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Saturday Night Live, and Kristen Milioti, who was the mom on the final season of How I Met Your Mother. She was also in a really great episode of Black Mirror as well in season 2, I think. The idea is that he's trapped in a temporal paradox, similar to Groundhog's Day. The idea is that whenever he falls asleep, his day starts over again, and he's always at this wedding or where his girlfriend is in the wedding party. And he basically is stuck in this loop, and he accidentally gets the Kristen Milioti character stuck in the same loop. And it's got some hints of these other type of, you know, obviously this as a you know, sci-fi storytelling method. It's not unfamiliar territory, but where they go with it, how the two of them deal with it together and separately, and then some of the ways that sort of plays out is extremely funny and fun and interesting. And there's a real interesting, you know, the male perspective, the female perspective, and some of that stuff too. It J.K. Simmons is also in it, who I really, really enjoy as a performer. It's really, really, really watchable. I would highly recommend making the time for that one. It might be easy to sort of look at it as a user sort of scanning past things on the streaming service and sort of say, oh, it looks like a rom-com or you know, whatever it is, but it's actually, you know, it's an interesting sort of take on the sort of what do you do if you're sort of living this time over and over again? How do you deal with that? What do you do? You know, it's not the sort of Bill Murray Groundhog's Day, well, the secret to getting out is to have the perfect day. It's much, much more complicated than that. You know, it is much more science-y than that. It's much more, you know, temporal mechanics and it's a little bit more of a thinker, which is kind of cool for sort of, you know, sciencey nerds. And Andy Samberg's funny and Kristen Milioti is very, very charming and it just somehow it really works. So yeah, I would say if you haven't seen that one, make time for it.
For sure. Okay. Cool. Well, I guess that's it for another week, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another year.
No, we got one more this year.
One more in the calendar year.
One more. Okay. Well, yeah. And by the way, Merry Christmas for those of you, you know, it's now Christmas here in this part of the world. I mean, it's got a few more hours to go.
Yeah. Merry Christmas.
And it's a white Christmas here, yeah, too. We're getting dumped on as we speak.
Yeah. It's supposed to be like really, really a lot of snow. Anywho, I guess that's it. So, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
I'm on Twitter. It's at Dev of the Hair.
All right. And Jonathan, if people want to get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram is at JPK News.
All right. My name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. So until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
Bye. Merry Christmas.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spockcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpockcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/Spockcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spockcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
It's getting cold here because the thermostat turns itself off around midnight. So,
yep,
I'm good to call it a day. It was a long episode.
Yeah. Well, you know, we kind of went off on Star Wars at the end there.
Yeah. Well, so we went off on Mandalorian as well, and that whole Star Trek thing as well.
Yeah. It's been a good week for sci-fi, though. This little stretch has been really interesting. So, Jaime, what are you going to do with your week? What's on the top of the priority list?
With regard to what specifically?
Well, so you've got time off, and you're gonna have HBO Max, you're gonna have Disney Plus. What are you soaking into this weekend?
So definitely gonna do the Wonder Woman 1984. Since we have HBO Max, we probably end up continuing with Succession. Mm-hmm. I probably end up watching the final two seasons of Curb Your Enthusiasm. I didn't mention this on the show, but we watched the first episode of The Stand, which just came out. It looks like the second episode just came out today.
That's the Stephen King thing.
It is based on Stephen. It's interesting.
CBS All Access, is that where that's showing?
It's on CBS All Access. Yeah. So I was looking. I was like, all right. So Discovery looks like ends January 7th, but since it started on October 15th, that means that I would have until January 15th. Well, The Stand ends February 11th. So if we paid for one more month after Disco, we would be able to watch the entirety of The Stand. So
that's how they get you.
Yeah. Maybe, because I mean, The Stand is just so perfectly timed for the current pandemic world where, the world is decimated by a plague. And so I feel I didn't add it to the watch list because I was still a little unsure how I felt about it. It's like, is this escapism or is this just throwing salt in the wound given the current state of the world,
Yeah. But don't you find that your perspective has changed on somebody? Like, I think I watched, what did I watch? The second Prometheus one.
Alien
Covenant?
Covenant or something?
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Yeah, and they had that whole sort of, people getting affected, just in the air.
Yeah.
That had a whole new perspective because before it was unbelievable,
Yeah.
Inconceivable.
Oh, yeah. Right. I was out doing some last minute shopping before our big lockdown starts and Christmas starts today. And one of the stores we went into had a bunch of board games and sort of those interactive games that you play as a group. And of course, there's a series called Pandemic that is a series of those sort of played together RPG kind of games. And Xavier looked at them and was like, well, that's aged badly. I was like, yeah, that's pretty bang on. Who wants to play the pandemic game? Like, hard pass.
Yeah.
I'm playing it in real life. It's not as fun as it seems.
Yeah, how do you play it? You go home and you don't talk to each other for like 4 months. Yeah,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Craziness.
So, Jaime, I don't know if you know, we're in a hard lockdown now from now until the 23rd of January at the earliest. The entire province of Ontario, that is.
Well, from Sudbury down.
Well, that's apparently. It. They're doing it for 2 weeks. We're doing it for a full month. Yeah.
I see. Yeah, we're in the second part of we're in the extended part because it started prior to Thanksgiving and then right before it was about to end, it said, oh yeah, actually we're going to extend it through after New Year's, I think. It's like a week or two after New Year's. So
have the numbers been going down there at least?
I'm so burnt out on the news, I can't even remember which direction the numbers are going. I think Washington State must be doing better because it's not on the state's list that have been trending higher. Mm. So it has at the very least evened out, if nothing else.
We had another record day today.
It's pretty grim out there.
It ebbs and flows. I mean, we still had people, they were interviewing people on the nightly news the local light news. We were like at SeaTac Airport and like, oh, so you're traveling. Yeah, you know, we wanted to see family. It's like, what are you guys doing? Like, if there were bombs going off in the place where your family was, you would just wish for them to get out. You would not go join them. Just think of it that way. It's sort of my opinion of it. But I expect that we will probably get another at least 2 week extension after the current one ends, which is sometime in the new year. So we'll probably end up matching you guys is what I think. Your third week of January, is that right? Yeah, I imagine that'll probably happen for us too.
Yeah, I couldn't get over the other night. I started watching the NBA season that started, and the Raptors weren't allowed to play here in Canada because of the
Buffalo Raptors, you mean?
No, the Tampa Raptors, actually. They're playing in Tampa, Raptors, Florida. Because, of course, if you could choose anywhere to be, you'd want to be in Florida right now. It is shocking to me because I watched that, and then I watched a little bit of some of the other games, which are happening in NBA stadiums. And there were fans in the stands for some of them. Like, depending on the conditions and the restrictions in some of those areas, there were fans. And I just could not wrap my head around that. Like, that anywhere feels that safe right now. It just seems flabbergasting.
It's not Harden was caught at the strip clubs and
protocol. That's the allegation. They say he said he wasn't in a strip club. They say he was in a strip club, but yeah. It seems so fraught. Like, it just seems, it all seems so overwhelming right now still.
Yeah. I think they need to do the bubble again for the season. I know it sucks. I know they didn't like it the first time, but it's probably the most practical one. Otherwise you end up like the NFL, which is skating on real thin ice with regard to what ends up happening for teams.
Yeah. Well, I guess all you can do is sit back and watch from afar.
Right, right.
Basics out of control. All right, folks. Have a Merry Christmas.
All right.
Yeah. Have a Merry Christmas, guys.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Talk to you next week.
Talk to you later.
Yep. All right,
see ya.
Bye.
Bye.